The Honourable Damon Bossino.
In the ordinary course of events are now what's been termed the traditional State of the Nation addresses during this appropriation bill debate. We would have had this session about 8 months after the October 2019 election. Unfortunately, as a result of the lockdowns, we weren't able to do so. Many members have mentioned this. But just dwelling on that election for a minute, I think it is an interesting fact that dawned on me when I was preparing for this, that all members elected to this chamber as a result of that election are all repeat members. We were all re-elected. Some of us had been members of this of the parliamentary session just before. Some of us have had more historic ties to this august chambers, other than one exception. And I think that this fact alone has stood us in good stead. We faced, as a society, the double threat that it continues to be Brexit, and of course the continues to be COVID-19. Pandemic. You know, there clearly exists a dividing line between the approach adopted by members opposite in relation to these aspects, as indeed there is with the approaches that we would have adopted. But what can be said is that it was handled by both sides of this House by experienced individuals. In a recent interview I gave to a Dutch publication called Jyllands Posten, which was reporting particularly on how Gibraltar had dealt with the pandemic. I emphasized 2 points. The first is the obvious and undeniable assistance that we received from the UK government in relation not only to the number of vaccines that were provided, but that they were actually provided free of charge. And secondly, that we all joined together in fighting this dreaded and invisible threat. That unity was particularly expressed by honourable members. I think we were able to share our intellectual resources in the shape particularly on this side of the House by the Leader of the Opposition and Mr. Clinton for really ultimately the survival of this place. That is what we were facing. As a people and a place which we all hold so very much dear. And I think it is also fair to say that we proved to be a shining example when compared to other jurisdictions, notably across the border, where, you know, political posturing and bickering was the order of the day when you had autonomous jurisdictions and regions raising political issues around what was such a very serious threat to them as well. It is right and proper that questions should be asked, and we welcome and look forward to the promised inquiry when it comes, when you know, questions will be asked, and we hope that open and transparent answers will be provided. But there is a time and a place for that. And whilst we were going through this struggle, it wasn't the time or the place to have done so. When I was given by the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition after the election the responsibilities of tourism and port, of course I had some opposition, at least experience, not governmental experience, but certainly opposition experience in respect of those both responsibilities. They were also given to me by Sepita Caruana and then by Mr. Fietem in the Parliament in which I served. And the usual sort of budgetary focus would have been expected to have been, you know, the usual debates about figures, hotel occupancy figures, airline arrival figures, etc., etc. And, you know, there would have been the usual point scoring, we did better than you, etc., etc. It wasn't to be, and it isn't the case on this occasion, in my respectful view, because, you know, little did one expect that there would be a complete and utter shutdown of this particular area of the economic activity, which fundamentally relies on the principle of free movement, of movement of people. Without movement of people, you simply don't have a tourist industry to talk about. The various reports which were laid before the House on Tuesday are a testament to that same point. And I think that is, again, an undeniable fact. What I would say as an aside in relation to that, but this is a matter of procedure, and it is a criticism by definition of members opposite, but it also applies to previous administrations, in that these reports, I think, are put before this House too late in the day, literally on the day that the debate on the appropriation bill commences. So it gives honourable members, particularly on this side of the House, who haven't been involved in the preparation of it, a very little time to fully digest them. I think it's a matter of procedure which we need to consider, reconsider, and amend if possible. But you know what the latest published figures, and I emphasise the word latest because the Honourable Minister for Tourism this morning, I understand why he does it, but he was making a comparison between the 2019 figures and the previous years. But what the latest figures show, the table which deals with visitor arrivals in Gibraltar, is that we have suffered a 52% decrease, which is huge by any estimation. In hotel occupancy terms, in airline figures, I can go through the details, but there have been drops and drops and drops. And this was recognised, as indeed it has to be recognised, by the Chief Minister himself, when he referred us to the fact that in his address that we had still not seen the return of day trippers by coach or by cruise liner in particular. I think the numbers as far as cruise liner arrivals is concerned has been zero since this thing started. And the Honourable Minister for Economic Development also, and I quote him, he said the fall in numbers is quite dramatic. I mean, this is all obvious points to make. And that stark reality has, of course, been recognised and acknowledged by this side of the House. But as explained earlier, we have, to the best of our ability, made our own contribution, especially in the early part of the pandemic, to assist, for example, in relation to the BEAT proposals, and we hope that contribution has served Gibraltar well. We put our political differences to one side, and our collective shoulders were firmly and resolutely placed on the wheel. But, as happens in our Westminster-style democracy, it is what it is. It is adversarial by its very nature. There was a time to part ways. And in relation to this, I wish to dwell on one particular aspect, which is the Lionwall Road. And I must say that nothing of what the Honourable Member, Mr. Isola, the Minister for Financial Services, has said, assists Mr. Derinani. It was an obvious, as I would term it, a defence in anticipation, and he was right to refer to it, of what I was going to say. You know, we have seen it in this House in the past, when the Chief Minister also, at every possible opportunity, rises to defend the Honourable Minister for Tourism, but clearly he requires that defence. And in relation to what Mr. Isola said and his contribution, let me say that, I mean, there are various explanations for this. One of them is, actually, that he could be postulating himself as a potential future leader of the GSLP. It's fair enough. You, yes. That's a possibility, because I didn't quite understand it. I didn't quite understand it, Mr. Speaker, because he didn't keep to his usual ministerial responsibilities, which I dare say were the more boring aspects of his, but nevertheless important, but the more boring aspects of his delivery. I found his delivery very enjoyable, I must say. And the other thing is, the other possible explanation is that if one looks at the order, the itinerary that we have set out, we have Mr. Isola, and we have some of us speaking. Mr. Feetham to my left will be the final GSD contributor. And then we will have Mr. Ligudi as the Honourable Backbencher, who has no ministerial responsibilities. We'll see what he has to say. And then, obviously, the Honourable the Chief Minister will treat us to his usual reply, which I look forward to. But, you know, the other explanation is that we're going to have three bites of the cherry. We're going to have, in effect, three sweepers on behalf of the government. Look, it could be a concern, dare I say, that they are concerned and worried about what we have been saying on this side of the house. But, you know, dealing with this, the debunked Lion Wall Road closure proposal, not an area of my responsibility. Not an area of my responsibility, but I think it is important to set it out as a backdrop of what the Honourable Minister's modus operandi is. And here we have a case of the newest member of this House, as I said at the beginning. I was referring to him. He was the exception that proved the rule. Trying to, you know, prove his worth. And presumably also, and I dare say, I think I'm still his friend, I don't know. I would advise him that he shouldn't continue along this route. Because he obviously what he wants to do, and he must be obsessed by this, is to improve his electoral ratings, because he came last of his particular team. So he came up with this great initiative. An initiative which entailed the closure of one of our main two remaining arteries, which takes us north-south and south-north in this very small peninsula. No one doubts, and no one doubted at the time, that one of the few benefits of the lockdown, if I may say so, the silver lining, I suppose, that's in every cloud, is that we had less traffic, yes, and therefore less pollution. Those of us who run didn't have to do it early in the morning because you weren't suffering the traffic chaos that we normally have to endure. Those of us who ride bicycles were freer to do so, of course. And I may have seen the attractiveness of closing one, but did he not realize that this was going to cause huge amounts of traffic chaos? Was he incapable, as he clearly was, of seeing the immediate challenge that closure of a major thoroughfare in this small space of ours would have? And he clearly did not, because he pressed ahead. He pressed ahead with his pilot scheme. I mean, Honourable the Chief Minister, you know, laughs, but that's exactly what he did. Right? And, you know, and it caused, when there was, the reality on the ground was that there was traffic chaos and havoc, he disdainfully dismissed this. Oh, it's the usual, as he said on a GBC interview, it's the usual traffic that we see at 9 o'clock in the morning, not seeing the reality of the effects of his policy initiative, of one of his, you know, brainwaves, and there are more to count and to deal with in this contribution. And after spending a lot of valuable pennies on fancy designs, so despite the furore that his initiative caused, he continued to insist on pressing ahead. Outside number six, I think it was outside number six, he gave a GBC interview, and he said, no, Lion Wall Road would go ahead. Only for a few months later to be completely debunked by his political leader to his left. No, he means it left the other one.
He's right.
To his left.
Oh, his left.
Yes. So, yeah. And that individual, the leader of the House, obviously has a much keener eye on political ratings and on his own political survival, and knew that that was a supremely unpopular idea. I'm surprised they didn't see it from word go, and abandoned it. Now, if that particular episode wasn't enough, we then, you know, little did we know that it was an expression of this individual's modus operandi. But maybe we should have. Because people will recall, and if they don't, we will continue to remind them, you know, how his usual attention-grabbing, headline-grabbing, self-centered style, took the better of him when he announced the supposed arrival of the Volotea flights from Bilbao. A new route. The first flights to Spain. This is all the result of all the many new routes that we're going to have all across the EU as a result of the framework agreement. And that was hailed with the usual bluster that he spouts when he wishes to impart good news. At least today, I must say, today, we have seen the possibility of a change in the Honourable Member. Where he, I think, as a result of raw experience, he acknowledges and sees that sometimes he's not the deliverer always of good news. And that's the type of humility I'd like to see him impart once in a while. And maybe it's just his political immaturity that has led him down this road. Because he makes us want to believe that he's the greatest and most effective tourism minister, not just of this party, but of every single government. All previously, including theirs. That is what his statements belie. But then, of course, Voltaire was not to be. Because shortly thereafter, I think it was a GBC report, which said, look, Voltaire reporting, I think it was the Gibraltar flights weren't available on the website, something like that. We investigated it, and it was true. I mean, I couldn't believe my eyes. I mean, I take the Honourable Gentleman on his word. I just could not believe my eyes when I was reading that this wasn't going to happen because they didn't have the required licenses. And borrowing the Honourable Sir Joe Bosano's words the other day, it was yesterday, you lose track of time now in this place, is, you know, you couldn't make it up. But again, as with Lionel Road, it came, his bluster and hype came shattering down in a very public and embarrassing way. But what did we have? I'm suggesting a resignation. I think what I said is that in a bigger parliament, that may have happened. But as a minimum, we should have had just a basic apology. This is not going to happen. You know, whatever. But no, he continued. I mean, I don't know how many press releases we exchanged on the matter. But I wasn't going to let it go. I was not going to let it go. And I had 10 or more press releases on the matter because he wasn't admitting his error and the error of his ways, his mistake. Again, lack of humility, and what we were subjected to is the most blatant, you know, hand washing and using biblical terms since Pontius Pilate, possibly. Speaker, when. When with this gentleman, the words success has many fathers but failure is an awful really do come to life. Let's go to the next example. Because the boasting continued. The boasting was relentless. This man had just arrived. He was going to do wonderful things. But I see a change in him. So I'm hopeful. And I pray that that will change. So, we've seen him once again, frantically associating himself with another new route, as he does with each and every announcement. That he should be happy that he has managed to secure, although I have something to say about that as well, whether it's him or not, but that he has managed to secure new airlines and new routes, it's something which I accept, and it's something which you should do, and I do not criticize him for that. But I do criticize is his not having an eye on reality as to what we are facing here. Or does he really expect us to believe that, you know, his charm, his intellect, and his industry is what attracted these routes? That these are three attributes and qualities and adjectives which can't be applied to all previous ministers for tourism? Does he really expect us to believe that? You know, Horace Emmett from the ACR, Joe Pilcher from the first GSOP administrations, Joe Holliday from the, we hope, the first GSD administrations, and the Honourable Mr. Neil Costa when he was in this house. He's beaten them all. He's beaten them all. Without wishing to spoil his day or rain on his parade, I tell him that the possible answer is likely to reside elsewhere. And the reality is that if you speak to anybody who has some knowledge of this industry, the reality is that planes need to be in the air. And Gibraltar, yeah, the reality is, was one of the few European destinations which was, you know, green-lighted. So it became an attractive place from the UK to send airlines to. And that is why the opposite is also true. Why, in relation to Wizz Air, we saw the cancellation of the flights to August. He has admitted so himself to the public broadcaster. But again, he brushes that off. Well, that's not the way he announced the arrival of that new route. No? He talked about how great it was going to be, and we hope to have a long-term relationship with him. And, you know, Of course I'm happy. Of course I'm happy. And but I'm telling him that he needs to change his chip and he needs to change his tune. Because it hasn't happened. It hasn't happened. And August has been cancelled. And as I understand, the mid-week July flights are also a cause for concern. And of course, I would be happy if this carried on. We want new routes to come here. That's good for this place. But he needs to admit that the recent spate of announcements has less to do with the honourable member's supposed magic wand and more with the odd circumstances we're currently in. And that is the serious point. That is the serious point. Because the big question is whether Gibraltar will be able to continue to be a substantive and permanent destination for these airlines and routes, or whether Gibraltar has been used as a convenient stopgap to deal with the pressing commercial needs of these particular airlines. We sincerely hope it's the former and not the latter. The recent confirmation by the government, by way of press release of the 7th of July, to not to increase the upper ROC entrance fees is, of course, is welcome. And although the press release is, although it was an odd press release because it wasn't drafted in terms of response to the one that we issued, and we issued it on the back of reports that we had heard that the increase was imminent, is still to be welcome. And what I find odd about the Honourable Minister Isola's comment this morning is that he seems to imply, in response, I think, to some comment that my honourable friend Mr. Clinton made, that the increase will happen. That's what he seems to imply. But no. He said it wasn't going to happen. That's the position as it is now. We don't know when it's going to happen in the future. But the reality as it stands now, the increase is not going to happen. And that is a wise decision. This is a wise decision because it would have been completely the wrong time to have done so at this stage of the game. You know, tour operators book tours in advance, as do cruise liners, sometimes a couple of years in advance. And to have done so now would have had, as we feared, and some operators feared, would have had a significant negative effect. It is also welcome that the press release suggested that there will be discussions with the interested parties before they do so. And I think that I certainly recommend the government to do so because I think it's something, it is an initiative, and the pennies do count, as the Honourable Minister Isola said, that requires proper consultation. And before I move on to other areas of my responsibility, I wish to highlight 2 points. One is a question of recognition, and it was alluded to by the Honourable Minister Darianani earlier this morning. From my own discussions with the port and hoteliers, the commercial benefit that has been derived by the port, in particular, as a result of crew changes, has been a lifeline during the pandemic, when basically there were zero visitors coming to Gibraltar. The crew changes continued afoot with all the required COVID-19 restrictions and etc. So, and that is something which came as a bloodline, really, in many respects, during the horrific months of lockdown. And that reality really brings into sharp focus the importance that the port has to as an area of economic activity. One issue, and it's going to be one issue of many, many others, clearly. The question mark remains, and perhaps the Honourable Chief Minister may want to. If he doesn't want to, that's fine, but in the context of the negotiations in relation to the EU, is how the efficiency with which we can conduct these operations here may be impacted by the immigration elements, which will be also impacted by the possible negotiations with the EU, because it is a cause of concern. I'm sure he knows that as well as I do. The other small point relates to Airbnbs. I'm sure many honourable members know that this is a new form of accommodation which is provided here. The issue there is that it provides, it results in rather unfair competition with established hotels, and there are other jurisdictions which somehow regulate this. I know it must be very difficult to regulate and must be very difficult to enforce, but that is an issue which I would like to flag in the context of this contribution. It's all not all negative. In moving on to the CEO of the Gibraltar Tourist Board, before I embark on this aspect, I simply want to make the point that and associate myself with the comments of the Minister for Tourism in relation to Mr. Guerrero. I also, on this side of the House, we all wish him a happy retirement. He has done sterling work, I think, in this sphere. Yeah. I think he was employed, has been employed, we were discussing earlier, for about 25 years. And I also think that he was, in fact, employed by us in our first administration. But the idea of moving, as he's confirmed earlier today, that role, that such sort of pivotal, important leadership role from Gibraltar to London, is, for us, simply doesn't have any legs. We have exchanged press releases on the matter, and we have exchanged views on the matter, but we simply don't follow the logic of it at this particular time. Again, as we've seen on other occasions, it's as usual with his thinking. He comes up with these bright ideas, and we have confirmation from the Honourable Chief Minister that the idea came from the Honourable Minister for Tourism. He said in one of his replies that it's devoid of wider thinking, in my respectful view to him and to the House. Doing that move, Mr. Guerrero retires, and not replacing that position here doesn't make sense. Moving it to London, is the answer that the Honourable Minister is going to have more of a hands-on approach to it? I think that's wrong. The minister should be there to guide policy and for civil servants or public servants to carry that out. And we think it presents a detachment and a separation, which simply makes no sense to us. The fact is that carrying out this move now, you're doing it at simply the wrong time. A rudder should be attached to the vessel, as I said in one press release, and not 1,500 miles away in London. So we think it's misguided and ill thought out. But look, we now wait with bated breath what the financial cost, because he's had to recruit London agents and all the rest of it, of this other Darianani special is going to be to this community. Financial services is one of those other areas of political and economic activity, which, quite properly, and is not normally the subject of political and heated adversarial debate, as I think has been acknowledged by the Honourable Member opposite, who has ministerial responsibility for this area. Yeah, I think we all recognise that this is one of those main areas of economic activity which produce the goods, and long may that remain to be the case. I think that I heard what he had to say this morning. It is very welcome to see to hear him speak about the very positive news that he was able to deliver to this House this morning in relation to the various areas, DLT, insurance, and also, although I think it requires probably greater analysis, I'm no doubt my friend Mr. Clinton will do so, the figures that he produced in the context of the Gibraltar International Bank. But on the face of it, and subject to that caveat, it's all very good and very positive, and we all do welcome that on this side of the House. I had prepared an element of this segment on the tax treaty. And I will deal with it. But then I'm afraid that the Minister for Economic Development is the cause for making my submission slightly longer, because certain things he said need to be responded to, in all fairness. Now, this is one of those exceptions broadly within this area, where there hasn't been a meeting, given that we were talking, so I was a bit worried about looking each other in the eye, where we haven't seen eye to eye. Each side of this house has expressed its view in public, and we expressed it as a result of the motion presented by my honourable and friend, the leader of the opposition. We have opposing views on that matter, and it's respectable. Right? We've exercised political judgments in relation to that, and we've expressed it. We had a debate. They won, as usual, because they have the inbuilt government majority. And the fact is that we now have a new international tax treaty with Spain. Time will tell. Let's leave it at that. That's what I had written. Time will tell whether the effect is going to be neutral, positive, or negative. I take great comfort from what the Honourable Chief Minister said, that, and I quote him, this is a success story in the making. Or I also quote my much maligned and misquoted article in Gibraltar Chronicle by the Honourable Mr. Joe Bossano. Incidentally, the contents of which, by which I still stand, because they represented my own impressions of what I saw before my very eyes as to the opposite views which are being expressed. But a bit of more of that later, because this is interesting, just to flag this at this stage, how the Honourable Sir Joe yesterday was only keen to deal with those aspects of the article which are critical of him, not of the government. And you're seeing more of that each time. I mean, he talks about willing to continue to be in politics beyond his original retirement date of 90. Because, of course, he's the one who decides when it's time to go. And I don't mean retirement.
He's the successor.
So, this is what I had to say in the article. I hope that it will usher in the bounty. This is positive. The bounty that some think it will bring in its wake, with the possibility of making possible the dream of an end to 300 years of abnormal relations. Maybe that's a bit too palomo for him. I don't know. And we sincerely hope that that's going to be the case, as Gibraltarians, quite frankly. But the reality is that, I don't know, his performance yesterday, it saddens me. Honestly, it does. Because this is a gentleman who's been knighted by the Queen. He has served in this house for, you know, I can't forget, because it coincides with the year that both the Honourable Chief Minister and I were born, in 1972. So 49 years. And that he should stoop so low, to be honest, was unbecoming of him. That's the reality of it. And in many respects, it was sad. Yes, I know. I know that the Honourable Members, the Honourable Friend here was telling me, yeah, no doubt, he will reply to what I'm saying now in a year's time. But that he should, quite frankly, attack me, because in some respects, he was insulting when he was talking about that I should see a psychologist. I mean, nowadays, dare I say, in this new culture that we live in, that may even be politically incorrect. I don't know. It may be, because he said that I had lost my wits were lost or something like that. I don't know. But he then, you know, has no compunction in referring, not suggesting it was a conversation in confidence or whatever, but it was a casual conversation. I think he'd just gone out to the laboratory and I happened to be there, maybe having a tea. Yeah, it was there. Well, he'd walk that way. And all I say about that is this serves as a public health warning to anybody who's listening, that each time they have conversations with the Honourable Gentleman, they should either take a full note after doing so, or try and agree with him, and I'm sure he would respect it, or I hope he would respect it, that it's going to be on a without prejudice basis, of whatever you talk about. Certainly if it's political, because you throw it at you. And then, you know, he makes, quite frankly, but I need to respond to it, the childish point, on about three occasions, that the Honourable Member is not in the chamber, that's why I can't look at him in the eye, making a reference to something that I had said, which actually I think was probably my last debate in GBC in 2016, straight after the Brexit vote, that I wasn't in the chamber. This is, quite apart from the fact, it hurts me in the sense that I am here, and in fact we were having this conversation, and I won't snitch on them, with some members opposite, how it's actually discourteous not to listen to other Honourable Members, irrespective of which side of the House you're in. That is the system we have here, right? I wasn't here. But I think it's discourteous not to do so. That is, I start from that premise, okay? And even, I try and avoid looking at my mobile, as most people do when they're looking at their mobile. I try and listen. It actually makes the time go by a bit quicker. And to be criticized for that reason, when I was attending to something personal, and coming from the honorable member who left straight after, I suppose he asked him to stay, at least for him, straight after the honorable chief minister finished his address. He didn't even have the courtesy of listening to the leader of the opposition. Of course, he went off to prepare his speech, and then came when he had to deliver his address, and I don't think he was seen after that until now. So at least we can look at each other straight in the eye across the floor of the house. So, I don't know, Mr. Speaker. Then he makes a reference, and I know he couches it in terms respectfully, we live in a tolerant society, yeah, but he talks about my pious and traditional Christian views, which I hold, and I'm open about it. But why did he have to mention in this context? Why? Why was that relevant? Why was that relevant? So, I think basically it was infradig and demeaning of the honourable gentleman, and it's like, you know, it's like, it saddens me. And I need to, I made the point earlier about misquoting my article. He did, even when he was supposedly reading for it, I couldn't believe it. But then he then makes a reference to later on when he's talking about, I'm not against this cooperation, as the Honourable Mr. Bosino had said. I never said that. I mean, where were you? You know, I've been following politics since I was 14 or 15, as most of us geeks here have. And I remember when he went to Seville. I think he also went to Seville, if I'm not mistaken, as part of the same process. I think he also did. But, you know, I've followed all his interviews, etc. But, you know, to say that I had said that he was against corporations is not true. I had said, in the context of his lack of hawkishness during the course of that debate, which really left me gobsmacked, and I wish we hadn't had that exchange, because apparently it was my exchange, which was the catalyst for him intervening, is that he had said, no, 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 a la Margaret Thatcher, in relation to the Strasbourg process of the late 70s, in relation to the Lisbon Agreement, again, I think late 70s or early 80s, and in relation to the Airport Agreement of 1984, we've all followed that. And that was the order. No, no, no. And then eventually the Airport Agreement as well. That is the point I've made. Not that he doesn't want cooperation. But look, I would much rather dwell on the very last bit of his address, when he was talking about Gibraltar's potential economic development and his new economic plan, than all the negative stuff, and quite frankly, rather infantile stuff, but I feel that I had to respond to. Because I really do hope and wish that what he's talking about in terms of the possible new the ventures that could happen by us looking north to the UK and south to Morocco may indeed happen. And in relation to the corporate tax increase, it's the same as my position, our position in relation to the tax treaty, which it has the potential of, at first blush, this is the increase from 10 to 12.5%, of making us less competitive. I think, again, that's an obvious point to make. It will, for example, it may put us at the same level, as I understand the Republic of Ireland has the same tax rate. But look, it is understood what the Chief Minister took us in at great length through, that this is as a result of the OECD initiatives in this sphere, and that has to be given due weight, and we are conscious and alive to the macro considerations. So there's something I suppose we'd rather not do, but we take an overview, and I think on balance, the government has taken the view that it is better for this jurisdiction to be seen as a compliant territory rather than the two or three I think he mentioned, which are still outside of the sphere. 80, okay. But there are 139, I think, who are in, thereabouts.
131 in, 8
out, for the sake of the Hansard, as he has said across the floor of the House. The Minister Isola made a reference and thanked his staff and other associations
who have helped in relation to the other pieces of legislation. I think it is also accurate to say that, because in fact he's on Hansard has acknowledged the assistance that we've provided in the context of some of the legislation that he referred to earlier. I talk about the Limited Partnership Act, the Protected Cell Limited Partnerships Act, and the mouthful that is the Process of Crime Miscellaneous Amendments Act, which I discussed a lot of the detail with him in draft form. We exchanged draft in preparation for the debates, I think it was back in February. And because, you know, many people don't realize actually that there's a lot of work that happens, which is outside the adversarial sphere, so to speak. There's a lot of work that happens conjointly, and there's some work which happens on occasions outside of the House. My view is that, given the way that we're currently run our affairs here, it makes sense if there is the possibility of reaching a consensus view on legislation, to make it better law, to try and agree as much as possible with the relevant minister opposite, and then to come as far as possible, subject to recording what's been agreed in Hansard, with a joint approach. And that is exactly what we did in relation to those three pieces of legislation that we talked about. In relation to the Process of Crime Act, that was a particularly important bill for this jurisdiction. It was a particularly heavy one as well. As the Honourable the Minister mentioned in the course of reading of the bill, and I quote him, it was in order to address the technical deficiencies which arose as a result of the Money of Our report. And, you know, we sincerely hope on this side of the House that the result of those legislative changes and other initiatives which have to happen in this jurisdiction, we will get a much better rating next time. As for the other two, as again I quote him, it is hoped that it will place Gibraltar's funds industry in a strong position for many years to come. And we hope certainly that that is the case, because it's not just a question of, you know, how people who deal in these particular areas will benefit from it, but obviously it has a positive effect in terms of the other areas of our economy. On the appointment of the Financial Services Ombudsman, it wasn't touched upon by the member opposite. We have had a difference of view. It took us by surprise, I think, when it was raised in the context, so that just so people can remind themselves, in the context of the debate on the motion to appoint Dr. Quorum as the Public Services Ombudsman. And then, as an aside, we heard that the intention of the government, the policy intention of the government, is to also appoint him as the Financial Services Ombudsman. We had an exchange there, and then I'm asking questions in relation to that. You know, whilst there is a superficial attractiveness to that initiative, I think on bill scratching and further consideration, we think it's a wrong move. With all due respect to Dr. Quorum, I think he would agree so himself. We know his track record. It was reported to us by the move of the bill, the Chief Minister, that is not his area. And it is acknowledged that is the case, because the Honourable Member has said that he will be relying on advice. And look, you can be an expert, but you're not an expert of everything. But one thing is that. So what we would expect is that individual to have the required skill set. And then on occasions he may require some legal or accounting or banking advice, for which he will have to pay professional fees, presumably. But to have an individual who has absolutely no experience in that, clearly the effect of that is going to be that the advice is going to be quite onerous. And we still don't know, because we haven't seen it work in practice, but I understand that complaints, quite a lot of complaints are received in this sphere. And there's a potential, as I think I mentioned in one of the press releases, is that there's a risk, there's a potential for further complaints in relation to this area, financial services, etc., in the context of an economic downturn. So our view is that it will be much better for all concerned if we had somebody with the correct and required skill set to be able to discharge that role properly, rather than to have to rely heavily on outside advice. And actually, I think it's also unfair on Dr. Quorum himself. It would simply be an extra burden. Planning and heritage go together, especially in a small place. We have identified, after some consideration, that there are long-standingly, seemingly impossible problems which besiege planning and heritage. But we are confident that it is possible to address these. And I would highlight three aspects. One is the workings of the DPC, urban decay in the old town, and the general quality of life of an increasingly cramped Gibraltar. And all these issues are clearly interconnected as we're dealing with buildings. We believe that there should be further reform of the DPC. Could be, we don't know. I anticipate a possible reply from the G Minister that they reformed it. And I think it has to be acknowledged. I think at the time of the Honourable Leader of Opposition when he was in government, I think we introduced the town planning legislation, the new one. So there has to be acknowledged over a period of 20 or 30 years, there has been development. But I think now there is time, and certainly the policy decision that we've adopted, and it's very clearly set out in our manifesto, had we won government last time, we would have reformed it. And one of the ways that we would have reformed it is actually by divorcing from the DPC process any ministerial direct intervention. And I think there's also a requirement to have a more open and streamlined appeals process, which at the moment is, I think, too antiquated and complex. So, but I think a further wider point to make in this context is that we need a new Gibraltar development plan. If I'm not mistaken, the development plan is from 1991. Time goes. Time flies by when you're having good times. It's 20 years ago. The government promised it, but is not yet delivered. And look, we need one which is fit for our requirements now, not 20 years ago. But when it comes, I sincerely do hope there has to be the government's policy and approach, rather than policy, to respect it. Not just the spirit or use it as a guideline, to respect it to the letter, and not to have it ignored. And look, if we have been guilty of misdemeanors when we were on that side of the house, fine, so be it. But looking forward, we need to stop this for the sake of our children and our grandchildren and so forth. And then the second point that I mentioned is urban decay. Some of the housing that has been reported in GBC, and we all know about it, are more akin to Dickens' period than it is of, you know, this Gibraltar than we live in now. The malaise that we suffer with pre-war rents over decades, we have basically what happens is you end up with a landlord unable. This is the vicious circle. Tenants quite rightly complain. Landlords then complain because they don't make enough income from it, and they can't fix the dwellings, the buildings. And then what happens is you end up in the usual situation where the building is suffering from such decay that you lose fantastic gems that we've lost. And I mentioned one example, which is, you know, the Riso Bakery at Engineers Lane. And I think further down the line, we have the Rialto Cinema, which I hear is also, you know, subject of some risk. And I think it's a pity to lose those gems, because these things happen piecemeal. And then you look back in 10, 20 years' time, oh, what was it? And, you know, and Gibraltar's changed. And we need to do much more to stop an unwarranted demolition. And I think what we would do is have, you know, a very swift, you know, open and, you know, wide-ranging policy consultation with all interested parties, you know, the people who rent, landlords, Action for Housing, all the rest of it, and come up with a policy that's true. I know it's not easy, but it's something which we need to think about in terms of where we are, in terms of our planning. You can't have a narrow view in relation to these things. And I know in the context of what we heard over the last couple of days, what I'm going to sound now, is going to sound bizarre, but I just, you know, raise it there as a possible flag. I'm not coming up as a possible issue. I'm not coming up with specific details, but, you know, talking about heritage grants, tax base, rent zoning, all of that. In order, the important point that I make is to ensure that the vernacular architecture, which is so very much Gibraltarian, is maintained and protected. And in that context, you know, no rent payer should have to live in substandard accommodation, but also landlords who are seen as the villains in this context has to be recognized are also the victims because of the point that I made earlier. And then in relation to quality of life, again, over the last decades, because that's the time that the old members were in office, in the last decades, we have seen a change of Gibraltar. where, you know, a lot of it is encased in glass and more concrete and cement and steel. And some people will applaud this modernity. I, for one, don't. I think many people also don't. What we're seeing is that Gibraltar is becoming an increasing, people have been saying it for years, a concrete jungle where we have congested streets and ever-decreasing availability of places for our children to play in. So, you know, and it also has a risk of diluting what is our uniqueness, and interestingly, it also has an impact, all these things are linked together, on the other area of responsibility, which is where I started in relation to tourism. Because if you render everything nondescript and anonymous, then Gibraltar just becomes an uglier place to come to, and certainly to live in, and certainly it could also have an impact on our social fabric. So all these things are actually very important, and I don't think that we have had a proper political debate about these things. You know, many people complain about the four-year cycles, and we are all, you know, wanting the votes, and we present, you know, snazzy manifestos. The expectation is that the next manifestos are not going to be as snazzy in terms of the projects, etc., etc. But, you know, we need to think about this a bit more seriously and have a proper political debate. Devil's Tower Road, for example. Devil's Tower Road, you're seeing it. No? There's no obvious architectural plan. You're just seeing higher and higher buildings. As I said in my prepared speech, bleak towers encased in ever longer shadows and howling winds. You know, we're not against affordable housing, if that's the retort of the Honourable Chief Minister when he replies. You know, we're not against luxury apartments. And I know it's a very difficult balance to exercise, but there is no reason, other places have done it, there's no reason why this can't be achieved with greater thought in order to preserve and enhance our uniqueness and beauty. We must build better, moulding new development through planning and mitigation. It is not too late to temper new buildings with aesthetics through proper planning and architecture inspired by all that makes Gibraltar unique and beautiful. But we are uglifying the place, in my view, bit by bit. And I think we owe it to ourselves to be better, much better than this. Gibraltar, in which our forebears would be proud to see if they came to life, to see how far we have progressed, and for us, Gibraltar's sons and daughters who will aspire to live in it. And now, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to touch upon an area, finally, which is outside my area of responsibility. From a technical, political level, but not from a domestic basis, which is special needs. I feel I have to, discuss it with my honourable friend, friend Mr. Reyes, and we've agreed that I could raise this issue. And this is, I speak from a very personal perspective, but I think that I feel duty-bound to do so. And in that sense, I appreciate that it is left field, but you know, we've heard a lot of wonderful things being announced and reported on by members opposite. But that type of supposed utopia is not what many families are experiencing on the ground. Let me tell them that. There are many issues, and really in a very broad brush basis, you know, whether it's in relation to occupational therapy, where I know that children don't have the proper access to it. And that's super important for children with special needs. Speech therapy as well. Again, there have been wonderful people who have been available. One of them in particular, I think, has already retired. But I think we need to provide, either reorganize or provide more. And I think very importantly also in respect to the psychological and the psychiatric aspects of this. Because this doesn't affect just the child who is affected by it. Well, happens to the best of us. I'll get through it. There are families who do feel abandoned and at their wit's end. I better read it. you know, when the behavior of the children. Is so extreme and constant that it does have a psychological strain. And it does lead, thankfully, not in my case, but it does lead to marriage breakdowns, which adds another strain. This affects, as I said earlier, not just the child, but it affects the family, particularly the siblings, who tend to be more or less their age. And then it does have effects. I've spoken about this in Jib Talks. I'm afraid I also broke down. but it's something which is very raw for me. But this is a real situation of extreme stress. It's almost like, I don't know how you achieve this, but it's almost like you need to treat this as if there was an A&E situation. When you have a situation like this and you've had a bad day or whatever, you need somebody to talk to, somebody professional on the other end of the line who can, deal with the medication that's required, who can, give you a shoulder to cry on, who can, thankfully, in terms of my finances, I've got other possibilities and connections as well. But it shouldn't be like that, because I speak on behalf of many families as well. And please don't take this as something which is sort of being used for political advantage, honestly. It's something which needs to be addressed. What I find, and I say this with all due respect to honorable members opposite, I find it very annoying when they go through their box-ticking checklist exercise. And I was having this conversation with somebody this morning who deals with kids of this nature. And he was saying that when I hear the honorable gentleman opposite, the government minister saying all the wonderful things, and they have, but they need to understand what happens on the ground. They need to understand that, and it's not the utopia that they set out. It isn't. There are huge failings, and it is the role of politicians to empathize, and I'm sure many of them think they do, but until, please. You need to endure this to really understand this. No? By that, I'm not disqualifying them. But I unashamedly, this aspect, I do unashamedly flag this as an issue which has to be dealt with. And it would be remiss of me not to acknowledge the fact that we have a new St. Martin's school. But again, in relation to that, was there proper, maybe ministers aren't aware of this, but was there proper consultation or exchange of views? I'm sure he'd say yes, but I'm not sure that's the case in relation to the layout and stuff like that, or the fact that the honourable professor says in his report that he talks to St. Martin's School parents and special needs, and that's true. But again, I've repeated it myself. It's not the utopia that was set out for us yesterday. Families need immediate help, and they need it in real time. And the system is simply not currently working. And simply to end, Mr. Speaker, to acknowledge the help and assistance which the Honourable Clerk has provided to me, and I think to all individuals on this side of the House. He's always at the other end, available at the other end of a WhatsApp. And as I say, he's always been very helpful to my time when I was here before. Indeed, yourself, when you were a clerk, were also helpful, Mr. Speaker. And I just take this opportunity to wish him and his wife I'm sure whether she's going to be very happy, a happy retirement.
The Honourable Stephen Linares.
Mr. Speaker, this is my 21st budget speech and my 9th as a government minister. And before I carry on with my prepared speech, I'd like to say that apart from the last part that the honourable member said, all the other things that have been said here are shallow. And I've never, in my 21 years that I have been here, heard from the other side, because I used to take a lot of time preparing my budget speech, how shallow those are. But I won't get into them at all, because I think the Chief Minister will actually finish off the budget speech himself.
I'm going to wade in the sandbags of that shallow.
Okay. So, I will continue. Okay. Right. I will start my speech by giving a synopsis of what has been achieved over the last 2 years despite COVID-19 pandemic. This has not only changed our lives, but it has changed many working practices. And we have had to adopt and adapt to the situation to the best of our ability. My current responsibilities are housing, employment, youth and sport, so I will therefore start with housing. Since I was given the honour of becoming the Minister for Housing, one of my main goals has been to review all policies, schemes and agreements, including the whole of the Housing Act. And there I pause again away from the script, because the Honourable Member just mentioned the fact that we do not consult and we do not go into looking at how people live and the landlords, and we do not consult that. Well, I can tell you that I have extensively when I've been doing the Housing Act, but I will mention that a little bit later. So I'm happy to say that we have made considerable progress on this front, so much so that I intend to start publishing the new documents in the autumn. One of the main functions of the Housing Department is that of collection of rental payments. For this, there are numerous methods available, and the Department are actively contacting customers to get them to subscribe to one of those methods. These are deduction at source from wages or salaries or occupational pension, standing orders from clients' bank account, online via eGov portal, telephone payments, and we're working on having a direct debit system in place soon, and we will be calling on all clients to ask them to subscribe to this method of payment. As from the 14th of July 2020, the Housing Department has been providing scheduled appointments to tenants that could only pay via cash. Counters are opened twice a week for the scheduled payments. This happens in keeping with the social distancing measures set out by Public Health Gibraltar. Expanding the options available through which to make payments of rent gives the tenants the flexibility to be able to choose the payment methods. The department has ensured that the correct systems are in place to deal with non-payments of rent. Notifications are now issued automatically to alert the department of any tenant who commence to default on their rent. This process enables the department to contact the tenant far sooner than ever before in order to engage with them at an early stage before debts begin to build up. The Housing Department continues to assist tenants to arrange payments, plans, and to adjust an existing repayment plan to meet both their needs and ours. These meetings are very useful as it allows the department to identify those tenants who have genuine hardships and are unable to pay their rents. All such situations are looked at on a case-by-case basis. Careful consideration is given to those who may have real social and medical issues. This helps the department determine those who genuinely can't pay and those who simply do not want to pay. There are a total of 587 tenants with arrears agreements. A total of nearly 2 million has been secured via such agreements, representing 42% of the overall arrear figures. The continuation of the consorted effort to have rent payments deducted at source continues to be our top priority. I have already stated it is government's policy that all civil and public servants who are on government housing department's tenants should have their rents payments deducted from their salaries automatically. This is more convenient for the tenant, and at the same time, it ensures that none of them default or fall behind in their payments. I am pleased to say that 65% of rents are now collected via such secure methods by standing orders and deductions at source, etc. Despite having all these facilities available to them, there are still, regrettably, a minority of tenants who can pay and but do not want to pay. This category of tenants have no social or economic hardship. They do not qualify for rent relief, and yet they continue to default. In such cases, the housing department has no other option but to commence legal action or use any other legal means to recover unpaid debts. Honourable members will understand that the housing departments have taken a very proactive approach to the question of rent payment and rent arrears. The problem is being tackled at its roots. This is by ensuring that tenants do not fall behind in their payments in the first place. Having said this, I must sincerely thank the vast majority of people who do pay their rents diligently on a monthly basis. This makes up over 90% of housing tenants. The message to them is to continue to pay on time and to rest assured that this government will tackle those who do not pay. Mr. Speaker, on the 1st of July 2020, we announced the introduction of the new enforcement and compliance section in the Housing Department. This section is tasked with the department's litigation processes, antisocial behaviour, in-house complaints procedure, claims, ombudsman's queries, and the recovery of arrears, amongst other enforceable actions required in accordance with the Housing Act. Our view of the whole of the Housing Act, a review of the whole of the Housing Act, will go a long way in dealing with these complex issues. Another important part of the Housing Department is the Allocation Unit. A total of 387 housing allocations have been made since the 1st of April 2019 to the end of June 21. The Housing Department works closely with ERS and others in order to recover the properties of those tenants who have either passed away, been admitted to ERS, or have chosen to move to private accommodation. Those flats are immediately identified for applicants on the waiting list. I remind the House that the review of all tenancies continues to be undertaken and all records are being updated in order to provide a more efficient service. Mr. Speaker, the Housing Allocation Committee continues to provide valuable advice to the Housing Authority. This comprises of two independent members, a registered medical practitioner, an occupational therapist, and a social worker. The housing manager continues to meet with them on a monthly basis. Mr. Speaker, on many occasions there are housing issues which cut across the work of other departments and authorities. A considerable effort has been made to improve coordination and working practices. All departments now have a designated contact person. This has smoothed out the communication channels and has minimized the time taken to undertake tasks. The senior management of the Housing Department are full members of a multi-agency forum. This multi-agency forum is created precisely in order to deal with issues of elderly care, mental health, child protection, social care, and others. The forum reflects the commitment to work together and provide a framework in which this can happen. The main departments that housing have worked with are the Department of Equality, DES, the CSRO, RGP, Social Services, GHA, Prison Services, GTB, Drug Rehabilitation Services, the Fire and Rescue Services, and the Central Areas Unit and Car Parks Limited. Mr. Speaker, the Housing Department also works closely with the Town Planning and Building Control Department. The housing is linked to them via the applications received through e-planning project programs. Mr. Speaker, it is important to note that once the review of all the policies, schemes, agreements, etc. have concluded, many practices will change in order to safeguard our tenants. One of these will cover the strict implementation of alterations of flats. Although we have had a system in place, many tenants over the years have made alterations to the flats without permission. This sometimes has had a negative impact on other tenants. Appropriate paperwork such as plans, drawings, photographs and specifications will now have to be submitted to and then approved by the Land Work Panel. If approved by the Land Works Panel, tenants are also required to obtain planning permission from DPC prior to undertaking works. Mr. Speaker, COVID-19 pandemic has led to the digitization of all housing application forms. This has enabled our tenants and applicants generally to complete attached documents and send these to the Housing Department electronically, thereby avoiding foot traffic at our counters. This has been achieved by working closely with the digitization team in order to have all application forms available online. The Housing Department will continue to pursue this and enhance its facilities further with the introduction of its own website in order to be able to offer current up-to-date information and services. Mr. Speaker, as Minister for Housing, I'd like to remain in close contacts with our tenants. I have been able to do so via the relevant tenants association. I have already met up with most, if not all, of the constituted associations. I have also taken time to walk about the estates with members of the tenants association who have highlighted the issues that concerns them. The message to them is that we will work in partnership and coordinate in order to receive any issues that they may have. Matters like maintenance, antisocial behaviour, parking and general concerns have already been discussed. The feedback received from the Tenants Association is generally positive. In this context, I will encourage those tenants residing in housing estates to establish a committee which aims to benefit and enhance the living environment of the estate in collaboration with the Housing Department's officials. This will provide them with a collective forum to discuss matters related to their estates. The rapport that the department, as well as the Housing Works Agency, have now established with tenants via their association is a positive two-way process which benefits everyone. The government remains committed to tackle antisocial behaviour. The Housing Department has signed an MOU with the RGP, which allows us to work together to stamp it out. We will not allow a few troublemakers to make a misery of the lives of the majority of law-abiding citizens. I am therefore pleased that the RGP has initiated a neighbourhood policing in close consultation with the housing authorities. I am also pleased to say that I have met with the NGO Action for Housing 7 times since October 2019, despite the pandemic. And my officials have met with them 17 times in the same period. This makes a total of 24 meetings in the space of 19 months. In relation to the review of the Housing Act, we have had both written representations and meetings with representatives of tenants and landlords. Their views have been taken into consideration in our review of the Act. Mr. Speaker, the Housing Works Agency is a key component in all this. The Housing Works Agency's personnel provide assistance to the pensioner blocks during the lockdown and at the height of the pandemic as follows. Staff were stationed by the entrance of the pensioner blocks to facilitate the delivery of food, medicines and etc. to the tenants. Staff implemented all procedures as instructed by Civil Contingency Department. Staff delivered the Gibraltar Chronicle and the Palama to all tenants on a daily basis. Staff disposed of household rubbish on a daily basis. Staff assisted in contributing and collecting all medical forms and required and liaised with the GSP as necessary. The Housing Works Agency staff tailor-made a significant number of bed dividers for the Nightingale Wing. They also assisted in laying flooring and performed other auxiliary works. I wish to place on record my gratitude and that of my government for all this. The staff of our Housing Works Agency undertook their duties with a sense of responsibility and an awareness for the situation that deserves praise. Many thanks to them all. In addition to the above, the Housing Works Agency staff have been instrumental in coordinating and or actioning 15,000 work orders. This includes 221 occupational therapy works carried out at the cost of £321,000. There are 107 flats refurbished at the cost of £1.45 million and 1,772 emergency works at the cost of £236,000, together with many other proactive works. Mr. Speaker, the general public, and more specifically certain housing tenants, need to understand that what is on offer is government housing and not social housing. The vast majority of tenants are not social cases. In fact, there are some tenants who can easily afford to buy a flat on one of the affordable projects. There are some tenants who can afford to drive luxury, flashy cars and go on annual cruises. Yet, they can be, at the same time, the most demanding tenants. This narrow category of tenants wants everything done for them and complain about everything all the time, including about the small 3% rent increase. They take up some of the cases with rent arrears. They make up some of the cases that are on rent arrears, even though they are people who can afford to pay. That is why the Housing Act is being reviewed. We intend to take legal action to get them to pay. There are obviously others who are suffering genuine hardship, and we will continue to help as much as possible. Mr. Speaker, the House knows that government rents are and have always been well below the market value. Government rental accommodation is therefore heavily subsidized by the taxpayer. Let me illustrate the point. In monetary terms, the provision of the rental housing cost is in the region of 17 million. And the amount we collect from rent, even if we include all those arrears, is approximately 5 million. Therefore, the deficit is 12 million per annum. This does not include the 114 million that has been spent on upgrading, beautifying and refurbishing numerous housing estates all over Gibraltar. This program has clearly shown our commitment towards our tenants and our people. The taxpayer has a right to ask certain people that they pay their rents. The taxpayer also has a right to ask tenants for help in looking after the area in which they live in. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to from the housing to employment. Despite the fact that I have only been Minister for Employment for a few months, I have been able to appreciate the work that has been carried out during very challenging times. The Department of Employment have not only had to adapt to the COVID-19, but also to Brexit, which has added enormous pressure on them. It is therefore a credit to all the officers in this ministry, together with those at the Ministry of the Digital and Financial Services, to have developed the new fully digitized interactive government e-services for its business users. They have been able to change practices and to respond to the demands of Brexit negotiations and related contingency preparations in the area of employment and more specifically workers' rights. Simultaneously, the department has been maintaining its full offering to the general public and business alike by adapting ways of exchanging, engaging where necessary, and running multiple systems in parallel and testing the new digital systems. I am very pleased to say that currently all these systems are already being rolled out publicly to local employers. During the pandemic, it has been the Department of Employment who has been fundamental, and the Honourable Member said that they were fundamental as well in this help. They have been fundamental entity in ensuring that the BEAT support measures were administered correctly and therefore delivered deliverable reality as well as a total success. The Employment Department have been instrumental in managing the thousands of applications and direct inquiries in our government's monumental effort to support local businesses and their workforce during these unprecedented and difficult times. The Department of Employment have waived fees as a way of providing additional support to local employers who have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The government BEATS measures have shown to have reduced the number of possible redundancies, maintained static the level of unemployment, and thereby protect much of our economy that could have otherwise suffered directly as a result of the pandemic. Now, as we hopefully continue to move through unlocking, and on the other side, we hope, of the pandemic, let's keep our fingers crossed, because lately that might not be the case, we see even in these most difficult times that unemployment, although unavoidably affected, has remained stable and Gibraltar continues to boast low unemployment levels. Mr. Speaker, the following statistics were mentioned by the Chief Minister in his speech, but I am happy and proud to repeat them again because of how good and positive they are. As at October 2020, the total number of employees' jobs in Gibraltar has decreased by 1,087, a small 3.6% drop from the 30,603 in 2009 to 29,516 in 2020. Average gross earning is £32,625.26, another record high, with an increase of 2.7%. The private sector has recorded a decrease in jobs of 1,214 from 24,001 to 22,787 in October 2020. The public sector and the MOD have seen an increase of 1.9 and 2.1 respectively to 6,232 and 497 when compared to October 2019. The model of success is establishing the number of persons unemployed year by year reflects the excellent work undertaken by the service. This has been developed and established by long-term close working relationship with our local employers and business community, understanding their needs as well as understanding the specific individual needs of those persons registered who are either unemployed or looking for alternative employment. With this, the employment service, despite ongoing pressures, continues to see our dedicated employment team working tirelessly to provide the best possible support and advice to service users. Mr. Speaker, under this government, despite external events and due to all our efforts, we continue to see record low unemployment. In 2020, with Brexit looming us and a year of pandemic, the yearly average was a record low of 21. So our current unemployment level is 0.07%. This is a 95% reduction in unemployment since 2011. In the last quarter of 2020, as we battled to support the return to normal businesses operation, we again achieved a low figure. The last quarter average of unemployment is 23. It's the lowest ever recorded in unemployment history and records since records began. In 2021, we have continued to maintain low unemployment levels with the 21 second quarter average of unemployed again at 23. Mr. Speaker, now more than ever is proof that this government's systems work, and it continues to work well, even under the testing times that we are living in. The Labour Inspectorate strategy and programme of inspections across the various industries, although delayed during the worst impact of the pandemic, now continue to operate diligently and effectively. This government reiterates its commitment to the eradication of illegal labour by ensuring that all businesses are compliant within the employment regulations. Labour Inspectorate remains as well available to provide information, guidance and advice to both employers and employees. In the same way as the Health and Safety Inspectorate continues to provide excellent level of service, they continue to deal with all matters, especially issues related to contractors and developers. The Health and Safety Inspectorate also remains available to anyone that requires best practice guidance and advice in respect of health and safety issues at work. Gibraltar is pleased to have seen is pleased not to have seen any fatality at work for over 10 years now. Mr. Speaker, finally, the Department of Employment, despite all these challenges, continue to advance towards meeting the government's commitment on e-services and being the first department to be fully interactively digitally. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to youth service. As a Minister for Youth, I am happy to say that the youth service opened its doors as soon as the civil contingency rules allowed. It has created and developed programs that have reached more young people than ever. These difficult times where many young people have suffered lockdowns and have been confined to their homes, the youth service, within the limits of COVID-19 pandemic, has become a vital part of relieving the stress and anxieties created by the pandemic. The youth service deals with young people from the ages of 12 to 25. The program that they develop have concentrated on increasing their social networkings through activities such as baking, going to local restaurants, team building games, group discussions that develop their understanding on different types of friendships, relationships and boundaries. They have further been able to develop their life skills in areas such as social etiquette, managing money, arranging their own outings, as well as attending GYS sessions and events. Obviously, some of these programs have been interrupted by the pandemic, but as soon as it has been possible, they have restarted. The youth service was able to run some programs during July and August 2019 when the schools were closed. They have also put together a choir called Joyful Riots, and they have been invited to perform for local charities, which have included the Happiness Foundation at the convent and the Gypsums at the Sandbone. This same group have created an urban garden using recyclable materials in the youth centre patio, showing their commitment to the environment. The youth production team in March 2020 was able to go to a residential in Seville in order to work at exploring cultural differences through photography. The youth service were involved in the Island Games event by having a youth cafe opened every evening, welcoming visitors across the islands. Mr. Speaker, other programs have concentrated on highlighting career paths that may be available to them. This has been achieved by reaching out to government departments and local businesses in order to facilitate inside experiences for young people on what it might be to work in these different areas. A total of 6 insight visits to various establishments have taken place, including the Royal Gibraltar Police, Classic Cuts, and the Fire Brigade and Nursing. All these programs have been delivered at the Laguna, Dolphin, and Plata Youth Club. Each club have offered programs that have involved travelling to different places. The Dolphin Club have been able to travel to Krakow in Poland, where they have visited the Kirkenun and Auschwitz concentration camps and the famous salt mines, as well as other historical sites. Young people from the Laguna Youth Club enjoyed day trips to Costa Jump, Aventura, Amazonia, High Ropes Course, a trip to Puerto Santa Maria, and a visit to the Second World War Command Center, and a visit to the cinema. At the Plata Youth Club, a unique opportunity to visit London was planned and delivered during the period, involving several of the Plata's old members who have shown commitment and positive participation over a long period of time. At Plata, the focus has been in catering for young people's personal and social development. All clubs have enjoyed organizing and having summer barbecues and Xmas parties and other outings. And Mr. Speaker, just to say off script as well, that we might underestimate the importance of these programs But in this day and age, when children have been shut in at home for so many hours, in which school has had to be cancelled, these programs are vital for the mental health of these children. And I invite more children and more young people that if they want to make themselves available or these, to go to the youth club. It is a place where they can feel safe, where they can learn a lot, and they can communicate with other people. Communication is vital in this day and age. These events have been of a great form of release for young people in troubled times. The Gibraltar Youth Service continues to form part and contribute to various multi-agency forums. These include the Child Protection Committee, Sub-Training Committee, Drug Advisory Council, Youth Advisory Council, and CHAMS, which is the Children Healthy and Active Multi-Agency Programs Initiative. Mr. Speaker, I want to thank the youth and community workers for their continued positive engagement with young people at a time when the world is encountering very many challenging issues. I have also been able to meet regularly with the Voice of Gibraltar people, young people. This group is a group of youngsters who bring to my attention any issues that concerns them. I am pleased to say that we have managed to discuss and resolved many of those issues. Some of the time, they simply want to be directed to the right person or place. One of the highlights of the youth service is Youth Day. This is done in conjunction with GCS. This year, the Youth Day Committee was formed and comprised by young people representing various youth organizations. The committee had an opportunity to debate and decide on all matters concerning Youth Day. Their responsibilities for delivering Youth Day ranged from choosing the day, the venue, email administration, promotion of events, as well as manning the event. Mr. Speaker, I will now turn on to my responsibility as Minister for Leisure. Mr. Speaker, the King's Bastion Leisure Centre has never looked back since our government implemented a series of reforms after we won the election of the 2011. From an expenditure of 2.6 million per annum and revenue of a mere 50,000, it has now an expenditure of 1.6 million and the revenue is nearly 800,000 in 2018. Unfortunately, in 2019, due to the pandemic, revenue has obviously decreased. Last year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, the Leisure Centre had to close down from the 15th of March to the 30th of June 2020 and from the 23rd of December to the end of January 21. Even when the facilities resumed operation after the initial lockdown, attendance was considerably down due to the various restrictions and where people were in that were in place to control the spread of the infection, and obviously people were also very reluctant to go there. It was during the March 2020 closure that the issue with the ice rink came to the light. One of the determining issues was that the cooling system was running on an old gas system that was out of date. We had to decide whether it was worth procuring a new system. This would have cost the centre approximately £500,000. The fact was that the ice rink cost only on electricity nearly £10,000 per month. There were only about 20 members of GISA using the rink and only a few from the general public. And to boot, there were constant leaks since the ice rink should never have been built on a second floor. The leaking water was also damaging the brand new bowling alley below that we had bought for the Island Games. So although it was a hard decision, that we decided in September 2020 to decommission the ice rink. So during the lockdown, LMS started to work on their next big project, which was the conversion of the ice rink into a boulder park. I am pleased to say that the boulder park is now up and running. We are already saving £10,000 on the electricity, saved ourselves the cost of £500,000 on the new cooling system, and we no longer have any problems with a leaking ceiling. The materials for the construction of the boulder park cost £120,000, which was paid for by using the capital expenditure allowance that LMS had left over from various years' savings. We expect that this new first-class facility will prove very popular with the local community and will encourage adventure sports seekers to take up this challenging activity. The rest of the capital expenditure allowance was used to purchase two new pinball machines at the amusement arcade. In addition to the facilities that LMS operate, i.e. the King's Bastion, the King's Balls, the fitness gym, and the amusement arcade, in 2020 they added the Cannonball store. This was due to open in April, but was delayed, and it eventually opened on the 1st of July 2020. The net income for the first 6 months was over £10,000, but they expect this to be much higher in 2021 as they extended the range of stock and their customer base keeps on growing. All in all, I am convinced that King's Bastion Leisure Centre will continue to improve. Despite the fact that revenue has decreased during the pandemic, it is still a far cry from what we inherited in 2011. On a final note, I would like to mention that during the lockdown, members of LMS staff assisted the Nightingale Hospital at the call centre and helped with the distribution of groceries to the homes of the elderly. All staff costs associated with this were paid by LMS, who also covered the full salary costs of its staff members during the closure via the set annual fee services that they get from government. We will continue, Mr. Speaker, I will continue with the next area of my responsibility, which is the Ministry of Sports. Whilst it has become a distant memory, we must not forget that because of the extended nature of the extraordinary financial year that was 2019-21, we cannot reflect that all that was done from the sporting perspective without starting with the Gibraltar's biggest sporting event ever. The 2019 Island Games were an unbridled success that saw 23 member islands descending on Gibraltar. The week of the 6th to the 12th of July 2019 lay witness to a fantastic sporting festival which had 1,624 athletes and 944 officials participating. In addition, 151 media representatives, most of whom travelled from participating islands, gave the Games and Gibraltar fantastic international exposure. We cannot forget the team of 574 volunteers. Without them, the Games would have simply not happened. The Games were held within budget and also registered direct revenues of £712,000. However, The wider economic impact of the Games was very noticeable, as there are restaurants, bars, shops and tourist sites were enjoyed by all those who attended, as well as their families. This gave rise to an increase in economic activity during the week of the competition and beyond. The Sunshine Games in 1995 were always revered by members' islands as one of the best. The 2019 organizing committee, led by Linda Alvarez, who I must once again thank publicly, rose to the challenge and put together another wonderful sporting experience. The Island Games have developed both the size and the quality of competition, venues, etc. These improvements bring challenges, particularly in small members like ours, but the smooth and seamless running of the events are a testament to the months and years of hard work and planning. This work provided a week that will live long in the memories of those who were involved, participated, or simply enjoyed the sporting actions as spectators. Finally, Mr. Speaker, legacy is a term bandied about all too often without substance, but the Games have left a tangible and lasting legacy in terms of infrastructure. We will soon have a full 52-meter pool with our local swimmers and water polo players making use of them, a full 400-meter running track, and an AstroTurf football pitch at Lathbury. The Games have left us a world-class shooting range and at the North Mole, and a target shooting range at the Europa Advance Road. A Special Olympics complex is also in place for use by our Special Olympians and others in our community. At Europa Point, we can already see the benefits of the rugby pitch, the use of the first-class squash courts, and soon the use of the cricket pitch. The pitch was also used for one of the largest ever music events and cultural festival, the GMF, Monkey Rocks, and the Bocelli concert all took place in this new venue. The multi-purpose hall, already in its short time in existence, has been used by badminton in the Island Games and as our last GMF second stage. It was also the venue of the World Junior Darts Competition. It became the Nightingale Hospital during the lockdown. It was the scene of the world title fight between Dillian White and Povetkin. Last but not least, it was the venue to the elevation of Mark Miles to Papal Nuncio and Archbishop. Mr. Speaker, no one can argue that this is not a multi-purpose hall. Furthermore, the Games have also left a legacy and sporting equipment and sporting development. Even though halted temporarily because of the pandemic, we will soon start reaping the rewards. The Island Games, however, not only the event hosted during the past financial year. COVID-19 ensured that, for obvious reasons, the period post March 2020 was very quiet and practically stagnant in terms of international hosting. However, prior to this, Gibraltar continued to host world-class events. These included, but not limited to, the International Chess Open, Junior Chess Open, European Backgammon Championships, International Squash Open, Gibraltar Darts Trophy, the World Pool Master, the World Snooker Master, European Hockey Nations Championship Men's, Junior Darts Cooperation World Championship, Rock Masters in Tempin Bowling, and several UEFA Champions League and European League qualifiers. All the above were held under the banner of events-led tourism and brought many visitors to Gibraltar. Our international reputation has grown, and we are now considered an extremely popular choice for international federations. The importance of this cannot be underestimated, more so in the current climate. Our local associations also continue to participate in international competitions, representing Gibraltar proudly and admirably. Sports development projects include coach training and mentoring. Also took place with the Gibraltar Sports Advisory Council considering application forms from all the registered governing bodies of sports. In summary, the level of financial support for sports grants has been a total of £610,113.43. Locally, competitions and development programs were held as usual, with one main difference being the addition of new sporting venues, including the fantastic sporting facilities at both comprehensive schools. The use of these went a long way to address many of the shortages in terms of indoor facilities and will no doubt prove crucial in the post-COVID-19 environment to provide sporting fraternity with tools to continue developing. The GSLA will continue to administer the use of these and provide a community use program to all registered governing bodies who will require one of these those facilities. We're working closely with the Department of Education in order to facilitate all these to our community. So thanks to the department for their cooperation in this.
You're very welcome.
As if summer 2019 had not been busy enough, the GSLA also had to run its now established summer sports and stay and play programs. The summer sports programs celebrated its 20th anniversary, and a celebratory evening was held to mark the occasion. It was great to see past leaders and many who have contributed to the success of the program reminiscing about what has been achieved in 20 years from a very humble beginnings. The summer sports program once again reported an extremely high attendance rate, with 318 children registered on the program. This figure not only accounts for those attending activities at the Bayside Sports Complex and organized directly by the GSLA, but 846 other children attended the numerous sessions and satellite activities held around Gibraltar, but still an integral part of the program. Unfortunately, with many activities, the sports program fell foul of COVID-19 and was not held in 2020. It was, however, felt that the stay and play program had to continue, giving its importance to the service users. In 2019, the stay and play program for children with disability was also a great success and catered for 31 children who enjoyed a summer full of fun and education activities. 2020 did, however, prove to be a pivotal time for the stay and play program. In COVID-19, whilst tragic in many respects, has made many reinvent themselves in relation to how services are delivered with restrictions and challenges that we face. The team at the GSLA Sports Development Unit restructured the program, creating bubbles and working in different sites in order to be able to address COVID-19 concerns. What they found was that those who attended in that case it was 26 children, found the program even more welcoming, and creation of small groups allowed for more meaningful interaction between leaders and children. Such was the success of the new setup that we will now become the modus operandi of moving forward. Sorry, Mr. Speaker, sports unfortunately were not immune from the impact of COVID-19, and sporting venues were one of the first to shut down and close its doors in March 2019. While the negative effects of inactivity are well documented, they became magnified in communities like ours, which has the highest participation rates per capita that I have ever seen. In fact, I challenge anyone to provide evidence that there is a more active country than Gibraltar. The enforced hiatus affects many sports, but I must congratulate and thank all the local entities who worked very closely with the GSLA to ensure that the return of sports was done in a safe and logical manner as part of the Unlock the Road map. This happened the first time round, and then after the second lockdown at the end of the year. Many had to reinvent themselves and look at alternative ways in which they could continue to provide their members, and in particular the junior elements of the associations, with activities within restrictions. Many have thankfully been able to complete their domestic seasons, with some of them preparing for upcoming international events. It is once again fantastic to feel the buzz return to our sporting facilities. Mr. Speaker, I would like to end my contribution on sports by thanking all the staff of the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority. As one of the first departments to feel the full impact of COVID-19 closures, the staff of the GSLA were immediately deployed to assist the community's wider efforts. Some were stationed at the primary care clinic, others in the contact tracing and the 111 call centres respectively. The role of the GSLA also included the manning of the golden hour, venues, as well as delivering food and other essential items to vulnerable in our community, including those living in HMGOG elderly residences. Those few left behind face the daunting task of having to assist in the setting up of the temporary morgue inside the newly constructed multi-use games area. The covering of the area, which has effectively become another sporting hall, cost £528,161, but no one could have imagined that its first use would be to house refrigerated trailers and a second CT scan for digital autopsies. Notwithstanding all that, they were asked to do, the staff at the GSLA undertook their duties with a responsibility and awareness of the situation that deserve praise. The really humbling thing to consider is that when they were asked to do it again in early 2020, their approach was just as positive. As with many others in our community, Gibraltar owes them a debt of gratitude. Mr. Speaker, the past 10 years in government, I have been responsible for 15 different portfolios. I can safely say that I would not have been able to do any of them without the support and professionalism of those in my ministry, who have followed me wherever I have been assigned to, past and present. For this, I am eternally grateful. They steer me on a day-to-day basis, running all my responsibilities. They have helped by getting involved in all my portfolios I have been given. Without them, I would not have been able to implement all the positive policies and manifesto commitments which I am involved in. They are definitely my right hand, who have and steer me and help me to deliver. But, Mr. Speaker, last but not least, I would like to thank you, your staff, and I would like to congratulate Mr. Martinez, and I hope he has an excellent retirement, which I'm sure he will be enjoying. So thank you, Mr. Speaker, the clerk, and all the staff of the Parliament. So therefore, I commend the bill to the House.
Mr. Speaker, given it's already 6:15 and we've been at it already for 2 hours, I wonder whether the House and the Deputy Chief Minister and I need to attend to some government business. I wonder whether the House could now adjourn for 25 minutes or half an hour to 6:45.
House will now recess until 6:45. The Honourable Edwin Reyes.
Mr. Speaker, this is my 13th address to this House. It was known as the budget debate, and I also happen to be the 13th member, to add a contribution after the presentation of the bill by the Honourable the Chief Minister and Leader of the House. So, Mr. Speaker, I wish to commence my contribution with sports-related matters, and once again I add that I am a firm believer in unity, where possible, for the benefit of Gibraltar's greater sporting interests. Therefore, I am glad to see the government continues with the long-existing policy to assist all local sporting bodies to overcome any foreign government's politically inspired attempts to block our memberships of international sporting bodies. The antics and, yes, shameful actions taken by our neighbours to the north are wearing even thinner as each year flies past, and I hope that slowly but surely international sports governing bodies will judge Gibraltar's membership applications on their own merits and not shamefully allow themselves to be coerced by our neighbours and justified and often totally unscrupulous arguments. In recent days, we have had sporting events cancelled with only a few hours' notice due to what it seems are political interferences which resulted in potential visiting sportsmen having to withdraw from much-anticipated events. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, Gibraltar's long-standing and cross-party policy of assisting sporting associations will certainly continue to receive the opposition's wholehearted support, and I sincerely wish sporting associations all the very best in their continuing battles to obtain their respective international memberships which are rightfully and legitimately theirs. Yes. Mr. Speaker, the GST opposition wishes in particular the Gibraltar Football Association all the very best in their ongoing refurbishment and upgrading of its own national stadium. It is particularly gratifying to see the Victoria Stadium almost full to capacity whenever our national team play a home game. What is now the home venue, that is the Victoria Stadium, was the location first promoted by the GST. It seems that where there is a will, there is a way, and therefore the GST has proved it was not wrong from the outset in choosing the Victoria Stadium location as the best site for an UEFA and FIFA fully approved facility. It is indeed far more viable and attractive option for local sports lovers to attend and even patriotically support our teams who have already commenced playing their qualifying home matches for the 21-22 season in respect of the European Champions League and Europa Conference League qualifications. I'm sure this House is unanimous in wishing our still remaining team participating within the European Champions League all the best in the forthcoming return leg game. Lincoln Red Imps FC have everything to play for in their next game in order to obtain qualification onto the next stage of the international European competition. Mr. Speaker, the forthcoming developments at Victoria Stadium should result in an improvement to football facilities in Gibraltar. However, despite this fantastic and ambitious project to be undertaken by the GFA, there is still a great need for further training facilities if our future generations are to aspire to improving their overall standards. It continues to break my heart to see so many Gibraltar registered football teams having to go across the border in order to train in preparation for local and international matches. Indeed, more facilities are very much needed if we are to continue to aspire progressing beyond the qualification stages in respect of international competitions. We believe that alongside the refurbished facilities, which will hopefully soon be enjoyed by our football fraternity, there is still a great need for extensive training facilities in Gibraltar to cater for our ever-increasing number of participants in numerous sports. These facilities should ensure that the introduction and development of our youngsters into the world of sports, very often arising from our school's sports curriculum and sporting club's commitments, are equally catered for. It is the duty of the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority to make these facilities available for our general public at large who wish to participate in any sporting activity. The new facilities, which were constructed in connection with the Island Games, should have been completed 2 years ago. And, beyond the Games, they were meant to enable Gibraltarian sports participants to continue to produce as best results as possible. With an increase of facilities, our sportsmen may develop their wide-ranging sporting talents. We have heard in this House of a range of excuses as to why our new facilities are still not fully completed, but the local sporting fraternity fear that alongside the unfortunate COVID-19 pandemic, there could be a certain element of managerial inefficiency and bad workmanship contributing to a now 2 years delay in what was hailed as a sporting showcase of facilities. It is totally unacceptable that with the month of July now near its end, the Gibraltar Cricket Association still has no availability of outdoor facilities in which to play any of its competitions. I look forward to the answers and explanations of why these facilities are still not available. We have quite often, Mr. Speaker, obtained results in numerous sporting disciplines which make our neighbours and sporting opponents in official competitions envious of our good and consistent performances. I sincerely hope that the new sports facilities, when eventually completed, will meet local requirements not only for today's needs, but for generations to come. I'm sure I speak for the whole House as we offer our collective best wishes to all forthcoming participants who, through their committed efforts, will hopefully yet again make Gibraltar proud of our sporting achievements in the season which is about to commence in just a few weeks' time, and which hopefully will not be subject to further major disruptions due to international travel restrictions such as those recently experienced due to the COVID pandemic. Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, I must repeat the offer I made at our last budget debate, as well as the year before and the year before that. Although I am a firm believer that individual sports governing bodies should be allowed to manage their own affairs with no external interference, I once again urge the Minister for Sports, more so in his capacity as Chairman of the Sports and Leisure Authority, to take a particular interest and, when necessary, appropriate action to ensure that publicly owned facilities are used in a fair manner for the benefit of all sports lovers. There is both a duty and obligation for the sports authority to ensure that, where desired by a club or individual citizen, membership in the relevant local governing body and use of sporting facilities are available and open to all in an equal and fair manner. Not only do we still have unresolved disputes pending now for a few years, but, most unfortunately, new disputes have arisen in other sports, and these matters cannot simply be ignored. Publicly owned facilities, built and maintained with taxpayers' money, should be available for use by all citizens. If a sports governing body must take some type of disciplinary action and impose sanctions upon a club or individual, then it should account for its decisions in a superior local governing body such as the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority. If an individual association is not held to account, then decisions taken, some of which at times may seem to be based upon personal vendettas against individuals, could simply be judged by the community as a whole as actually being condoned and approved by authorities such as the GSLA. And the GSLA is the ultimate landlord of sporting facilities that are used by a wide range of sportsmen. I yet again offer myself to sit down and discuss with the Minister for Sports possible avenues which may be looked into in order to set up a special independent body tasked with matters pertaining to and requiring possible arbitration in relation to local sports issues. Some disputes have been dragging on for far too long, and I am still hopeful that by working together with all affected parties, proper solutions can and should be found. Mr. Speaker, it is very gratifying to see that the summer sports program continues to be a very popular facility which is enjoyed by a large number of youngsters during the school's summer holidays. This original GSD program had small beginnings and then expanded into equally successful provisions such as the introduction of what is known as stay and play, which caters for potential participants who, for a variety of reasons, cannot fully enjoy the mainstream programs on offer. However, I believe the time has now come for a further review of programs being offered, and we should seriously consider the introduction of bespoke activities for those youngsters who have special needs which neither fit into the mainstream or the stay-and-play facilities. If we conduct a review or audit of what is currently available using the premise of sports for all, it could well be that other programs need and should be introduced for the future. Mr. Speaker, I wish to reaffirm my personal convictions that through the collective celebration of social events, participating Gibraltarians contribute towards reinforcing our identity, our culture, and our history as a people and as a community. Both the performing and fine arts fraternities have always proved themselves to be very proactive within their own specialized area, and I take this opportunity to congratulate all the groups and individuals who have done Gibraltar extremely proud through their international participations, and in many cases, even gaining top awards. It is always a personal and collective pleasure to be able to say how proud we are of the international achievements of our fellow Gibraltarians. During the last term in office, government purchased both the Queen's Cinema and Queen's Hotel sites for the development of a theatre and related activities. Government announced through its election manifesto that a lot of progress on the design of the new Queen's National Theatre had been made in order to make the old Queen's Cinema a venue for touring productions. They went on to say that now that preliminary land use designs had been finalised, they would continue to work with a committee of local drama experts in order to finalise the internal designs and facilities required. All this alongside exploring the possibility of commercial use of the theatre complex facilities. This year's estimates show a token provision of simply £1,000 under the Improvement and Development Fund expenditure set aside in Head 102, other projects, subhead 4, Sulu Sulu Juliet, entitled Theatre. Furthermore, it is now public knowledge that the Queen's National Theatre will not see the light of day, and instead a new project has been announced which will see an enlarged theatre created within the John McIntosh Hall. This theatre will be built with funds provided by public subscriptions, and therefore it does not say much for government's personal commitment to see through their original plans pertaining to theatrical facilities which they pledged they were going to provide. The new theatre, Mr. Speaker, will replace the existing John McIntosh Hall facilities, which currently has just over 200 seating capacity, but which is always greatly in demand for use by local schools and dance groups for their productions. It now leaves the question of where exactly traditional users of the existing hall will be able to stage their shows. With the refurbishment of John McIntosh Hall facilities, we are actually not providing much-needed additional facilities. It boils down to an exchange of a small facility for a much larger one, which would not necessarily cater for ever-increasing demands of theatre facilities. The new larger theatre might be good news for some, but it has also resulted in sad news for others, like local educational schools and dance groups for whom the size was just right. I wish the traditional users of the here-to-existing McIntosh Hall facilities the best of luck in finding alternative venues which cater for their specific needs. Local performers may often be heard to say that if we can afford £5,850,000 on a two-day mega concert, plus £62,000 for the jazz festival, with an additional £80,000 in respect of a world music festival, then surely our local performers, entertainers and audiences are entitled to ask for a theatre which is fit for purpose and available throughout for 365 days a year without having to raise the funds themselves. Mr. Speaker, moving on now onto educational matters, I wish to start by citing once again from a passage I have used before in this house. It says, children must be able to play, study and grow in a peaceful environment. Woe to anyone who stifles their joy, impulse to hope. With this in mind, I cannot stress enough the need to ensure we get it absolutely right when planning and building facilities which will serve our children's educational purposes in preparation for adult life. Much has been said in respect of government's recently completed educational programs that catered for the reprovision and expansion of our schools. For our pupils' benefits, I sincerely hope that decisions to be taken in respect of future projects will be based above all upon feedback received from the professionals in the field, namely from school teachers themselves. Unfortunately, the Gibraltar Teachers Association feel that on occasions they are ignored and not consulted on a number of educational reforms that the Department of Education had or are about to embark upon. As both a teacher and a past president of the Gibraltar Teachers Association, and someone who still has educational matters extremely close to his heart, I extend a recommendation to the Minister for Education to listen and continue to work as closely as possible with classroom teachers, albeit alongside his senior management teams. Classroom teachers want to be part of any process that improves our educational system and want to be involved in meaningful consultation before final decisions are taken. Surely, the way forward proposed by these professionals can only but contribute to the well-being and best possible future of our children. This is something which I hope we can all agree is paramount. I would like to take this opportunity to also recommend to the Minister that in their plans for resourcing of our schools, careful consideration be given to the current trends in respect of developments in schools' curriculums. Likewise, Mr. Speaker, the GSD have raised the concept of modern apprenticeships in the past, and we still believe we need to offer more in this field than we currently provide. Those pupils who do not wish to pursue an academic future need to be provided with the opportunity of a modern apprenticeship program, which, if properly structured, has the same standing as higher education. We need to create a gold standard for an apprenticeship program so that employers have confidence in the system. The time for investment is now, Mr. Speaker, not just in formal academic education heading towards entry into higher education, but also in the coordination of training and skills through properly structured vocational courses that carry international accreditation. We must not forget the ultimate aim of providing education for our future generations. It is our duty to ensure all pupils always achieve their maximum potential. The school leaving age in the United Kingdom, upon which we base our educational models, is set at age 16 if students then embark upon an apprenticeship or training type of employment until at least attaining the age of 18. I believe it is high time we reviewed our local school leaving age. For a pupil to leave schooling in Gibraltar at age 15 and not embark upon an approved training program is certainly not an investment in respect of the future employability prospects of that youngster. We are now in the third decade of the 21st century and decisive action is therefore long overdue. Whilst desiring only all the very best in respect of whatever educational reforms may be required over the next few years, I cannot but end by reinforcing that the views of the professionals in this field must be heard and acted upon. There is no better formula for success than to cultivate a sense of ownership amongst all professionals tasked with the education of our children. Furthermore, the GSD believes that school teachers are a priority that is both needed and from which society will receive huge benefits. The job they do benefits everyone. Teachers are not a group who are prone to industrial action or making a fuss about nothing. They do not crow the loudest. However, they are a key contributory factor towards the success of our future adults and their aspirations in the adult world. To all those teachers, Mr. Speaker, who go the extra mile, I thank you on behalf of all parents for assisting and thus enabling our youngsters to attain even greater successes than past generations have done. No one has been more critical of government spending than the GSD have been over the last few years. We have advocated prudence and pointed to the dangers of uncontrolled spending. This does not, however, amount to austerity. It is about prioritizing government spending in areas where it is needed or where, as a society, we are going to get the greatest benefit, and I firmly believe education is certainly one of those areas. To round up on educational matters, Mr. Speaker, I would like to say that given that our schools are currently in recess during these summer months, I respectfully suggest that a sensible and working traffic plan for the drop-off and collection of pupils be worked upon and put in place before the schools reopen this coming September. Many families depend on relatives, often elderly, to assist in the school runs, and on behalf of the many called upon to do so, I beg for a bit of common sense to prevail and thus assist in the lowering of, blood pressures among those who unfortunately are already in medication for this condition. Moving on to housing matters, Mr. Speaker, I must remind government of their 2011 manifesto promises, where they pledged that everybody on the pre-list and housing list as of December 2011 will be given a home within a four-year period. It is unacceptable that 10 years later there are still people waiting to be allocated a home. Yeah. 10 years ago there was no Brexit or pandemic, so therefore the electorate continues to be let down in this matter. Government may attempt to blame all previous administrations, but the reality today is that there is a need for housing, and it is the most vulnerable in Gibraltar who are suffering the worst. Most of the meetings I hold with constituents are about housing matters, and I thank pressure groups like Action for Housing for the sterling work they do in making the general public aware of the desperate housing needs of unfortunately so many in our community. Mr. Speaker, the rental market from private landlords is outside the reach of an average family. But when you hear the landlord's side of the story, it leads us to conclude that the present Housing Act is certainly in urgent need of review. This exercise should not end up penalising just the landlords when it comes to social housing for Gibraltarians. I would welcome today, Mr. Speaker, an update on the current sales of affordable homes, inclusive of updated estimated completion dates. Many purchasers are young couples who are facing financial difficulties due to having to make monthly payments towards the purchase of their homes, which are still being built, and still having to pay rents of over £1,000 per month in many cases, until the new affordable homes are ready to be moved into. The next problem they will face in the future is a shortage in availability of mortgage lending institutions, as lenders will only give out loans to a certain percentage of homes within a project. Perhaps the Chief Minister in his reply can offer some advice to those who will require to take on mortgages on how best to go about securing their soon mortgage needs. We have also spoken in the past about the availability of homes for the exclusive allocation and use by senior citizens. There are already certain provisions for those within the government rental homes set up, but unfortunately, demand still remains greater than the number of units available. I have exchanged views with many who bought their homes some 30 years ago when the affordable home schemes were first introduced. Those purchasers were once young, Mr. Speaker, and in receipt of average salaries which made their purchases possible. However, 30 years later, they have now become pensioners and subsequently have less of a monthly income from their pension fund. A common concern is that the private estates in which they live require them to pay service charges, and these inevitably go up every year. The reality is that despite having paid off their mortgages, these pensioners are still required to pay community charges, which on a monthly basis and on average are higher than the rent paid for a government flat. Furthermore, because once upon a time they committed themselves into purchasing their homes, they are now ineligible to apply for a home which has been purposely built for and caters for the needs of senior citizens. In recent difficult times, such as the lockdown suffered due to the COVID-19 pandemic, our senior citizens residing in senior citizens' homes enjoyed great support and assistance from the relevant official departments. However, those senior citizens who for years went through the financial expenses of purchasing their own homes found themselves abandoned, so to say, simply because they are residing in a non-government-owned home. Mr. Speaker, I think the time is now to put our thinking caps on and look into possible provisions for senior citizens to be able to move into purpose-built homes commensurate with their present needs. The gripe these senior citizens have is that in the past they had to sacrifice holidays and small luxuries in order to purchase their own homes, and now they are being somewhat discriminated upon when compared to the contemporaries who have always benefited from heavily subsidized government rental homes. I trust that the Minister for Housing and the Minister for the Elderly will be able to jointly look into this matter and discuss current concerns directly with the representative bodies who look after the interests of our senior citizens. Where there is a will, there is a way. Alas, what there is not too much is time left for our senior citizens, so therefore action must be taken now. Mr. Speaker, before I sit down, I must take this opportunity to once again thank you and all your staff at Parliament for the patient and professional manner in which you have all, both collectively and individually, dealt with us members. I know that you personally have always strived to lead by example when dealing by members on both sides of the House. And now, with your leave, Mr. Speaker, sir, I would like to wish a very happy retirement to our clerk, but not before posing the important question which perhaps he can answer. The question is, who will take on the task of ensuring that sufficient tea and coffee, alongside biscuits, are always in stock behind the Speaker's chair for hungry members? Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Daniel Feetham.
Exactly. Mr. Speaker, today I have been asked by the Leader of the Opposition to draw together some of the themes that we have highlighted in this year's debate and indeed, to respond, the sweeper, and respond where relevant. I'm certainly going to respond to you, that's for sure. Respond where relevant to some of the speeches from the government side. And of course, because the government knew that I was going to be responding to what they were saying, Mr. Speaker, that the government, who controls the timetable, has ensured that I have the black hole slot, Mr. Speaker, in this debate. Not even my mother, out of deep love and affection, is listening to what I have to say today, Mr. Speaker. Well, indeed, it's the only reason you've ensured that I am speaking at this time. Mr. Speaker, the English broadcaster Mark Steele once said, "The annoying thing about being an atheist is that you'll never have the satisfaction of saying to believers, 'I told you so.'" No, this is not friendly fire, I can tell you. I am not an atheist, Mr. Speaker, and it's perhaps not elegant in politics to say, "I told you so." But if the roles had been reversed, I suppose that the father of the house, who's not here to listen to my speech today, would have said, "If you want elegance, go to a fashion show, Mr. Speaker," and that is precisely what I say to the Honourable Gentleman, or to anybody who thinks that my intervention today will not be elegant, because they're certainly not going to like it. Mr. Speaker, the fact is that on the effects of public debt and unrestrained public spending, on the unsustainable increases in departmental expenditure and the public sector in general, on the way we warned that our size and economic model made us more vulnerable to international downturns than much larger, more diversified economies, on the way in particular, Mr. Speaker, in particular, that this was all creating a culture of expectation which was unsustainable and indeed socially, insipidly damaging to this community. We told you so, we told you so, and we told you so, Mr. Speaker. There is no point in the government coming to this House and saying that the age of entitlement is over, the age of responsibility is here, when they themselves have been more irresponsible than anyone, and they are the ones who have created the illness for which they now claim to have the cure, Mr. Speaker. Well, were the honourable members opposite? When I and my colleagues were being lambasted as the architects of austerity, when we were telling them we were telling them all the things that they have told the House need to happen over the course of this week, Mr. Speaker. It was like listening to opposition speeches over the last 7 years, Mr. Speaker. Keeping to governmental budgets, prudence, responsibility, not being all things to all men, Mr. Speaker. Where was the Honourable Mr. Isola? Where was Mr. Honourable Isola's mantra, every penny counts, when they were spending £14 million on the GMF, Mr. Speaker? Where was he, Mr. Speaker? And indeed, Mr. Speaker, and talk about contradictions, Mr. Speaker. He lambasts the former GSD government for PFI arrangements in relation to the hospital. Yes, you did. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, from page 220 of the estimates, the government is paying Europort, in respect to the Europort Paediatric Centre, £500,000 is projected for 2021, 2022. And for the Europort Primary Care Centre, £780,000. Now, Mr. Speaker, who's the owner of Europort, Mr. Speaker? Who is the owner of Europort? Well, Mr. Speaker, people in glass houses should not be throwing stones, Mr. Speaker. That's the reality of this. That's the reality. Now, Mr. Speaker, and of course, no one on this side of the House is saying that if they had been prudent with the people's money over the last 10 years, we could have avoided a £157 million deficit, which is, of course, COVID-related. And no one could have predicted the pandemic, but we certainly would have been in a better position. That's the point. We would have been in a better position to deal with this crisis, and we did consistently warn them about the potential but extremely serious curves up ahead. In 2015, Mr. Speaker, the GSD team would go around the estates in Hastings telling people, agárrense ustedes que vienen curva. And our warnings, Mr. Speaker, were ignored. Since at least 2017, those justified criticisms from this side of the House of the government's handling of the public finances has turned out to be the biggest "we told you so" in the political history of these debates. That's the reality, Mr. Speaker. That's the reality. COVID has undoubtedly been devastating. That is true. But the seeds of our economic problems and the undoubted social issues we warned were being created by the all things to all men policy of the government run much deeper, are more complex, and lie principally at the door of honourable members opposite, Mr. Speaker. It is not as if they were not warned, not only by us, principally so, but also at least by one other member of the government's benches, Mr. Speaker, the Minister for Economic Development, who has been so exasperated by the situation that it has prompted him to make some astonishing public statements in this House and outside this House over the years, some of which I'm going to be referring to during the course of my intervention today. It is in the management of the public finances that the differences between the government and the opposition have been most apparent over the last 10 years. And Mr. Speaker, those differences have not just, as the Leader of the Opposition emphasised during the course of his intervention, not just about transparency and accountability. In all the budget speeches that we have delivered over that time, we have always been at pains to emphasise that the systematic dismantling by the government of our ability to properly scrutinize the public's finances also interfered with our, and anybody interested in the democracy of Gibraltar, ability to identify the true extent of any present and future financial problems. And that was phenomenally dangerous, Mr. Speaker. Phenomenally dangerous. As the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition, has emphasised in his eloquent and articulate exposure of the government's deception in June 2011, when Honourable Members sat on this side of the House and we were debating the last budget of the last GSD government, direct public debt reflected for and accounted for in these estimates of revenue and expenditure stood at 480 million. And the debt in government-owned companies, 20 million. The total was 500 million. Today, direct gross public debt stands at 677.7 million, expected to rise, as the Honourable Mr. Clinton has said, to 747.7 million next year. Let that sink in, Mr. Speaker. But more importantly, the debt in government-owned companies has gone up from £20 million in 2011 to £959 million today, Mr. Speaker. From 20 to £959 million. There is more debt in government-owned companies than there is debt directly owed by the government. And more importantly, we do not know how much of that has been spent, Mr. Speaker. We don't even know how much interest is being paid on some of those loans, as Mr. Clinton pointed out, or how they will be repaid when they mature. If our warnings of the way that government was increasing debt, increasing spending, and in particular recurrent expenditure had been heeded, we would have been in a far better position to overcome the current crisis than we are today. Instead, the government has been intoxicated by the desire to pile on the votes at general elections, and that has had huge repercussions and has caused huge social damage to this community. And Mr. Speaker, when I say that, I know I can say that authoritatively. Like I can say, yes, like I can speak on nothing else, Mr. Speaker. Why? Because I was the Grinch of Gibraltar politics for many years, Mr. Speaker, warning about the direction of travel and the effect government policy was not only having on our finances, but on social attitudes, Mr. Speaker. Social attitudes not only now, but for the future. Actually, the genesis of why we are where we are today can be found as far back as the 2011 election, when members opposite made promises which could only have been kept at the expense of the systematic dismantling of parliamentary democracy with respect to our public finances. And that is very simple because, Mr. Speaker, they promised at the 2011 election, they promised to spend £750 million in capital projects. To then donate every last single penny of government surpluses, in other words, the profit the government makes, every last single penny to community care. And to boot, they also promised to reduce gross public debt. Now, Mr. Speaker, it doesn't take a rocket scientist that is an impossibility without political shenanigans. That's the reality. And of course, on top of all that, in December 2011, the whole of Gibraltar had their popcorn out, Mr. Speaker. We all had our popcorn out. When he comes out on public television, putting on his most serious face, as only he can, Mr. Speaker, and telling the people of Gibraltar, that's a month after the general election, my fellow Gibraltarians, we have found a 100 million black hole behind an impenetrable curtain. Mr. Speaker, for one moment, he had me with visions of being in a 6x6 cell at Windmill Hill and not knowing what I was going to say to my mother, Mr. Speaker. Such was the potency of the honourable gentleman's performance. I mean, it was Oscar worthy, Mr. Speaker. It was Oscar worthy. Mr. Speaker, I knew there was something not quite right when he then started to burn money as if there was no tomorrow. And barely a year later, and following the announcement of yet another multi-million pound project, Christine Vasquez asked him, how can you afford all this when less than a year ago you said there was a 100 million black hole? And he said, as Gibraltar reached again for its popcorn, Mr. Speaker, I have cured the problem. I have cured the problem. Mr. Speaker, of course, on this side of the House, we knew that promising to spend £750 million whilst at the same time gifting your profits to a charity and reducing public debt did not stack up. And that is why, as early as the debate in 2013, a few months after that interview, we said this, Mr. Speaker, in this debate. And I set it out because I feel immensely proud of the job that the opposition has done in these debates going back to 2012, Mr. Speaker. My quote, Mr. Speaker, if your cash reserves are down, you will not borrow directly because you don't want to increase net public debt. You also promise to donate every last single penny of surplus to community care. How on earth do they expect to fund 750 million in government projects? I then answered the rhetorical question, Mr. Speaker. Quote, or does the government intend to use, for example, deposits in the Gibraltar Savings Bank, which have shot up spectacularly, to fund those projects? Of course, Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Savings Bank debt securities do not appear in these estimates as public debt because it is not strictly a debt of the bank, not the government. Mr. Speaker, I've been observing the Honourable Minister responsible for the Gibraltar Savings Bank, that's Sir Joe, for a very long time indeed, and I may not always agree with him, but he has never done anything without a reason. I hope, Mr. Speaker, that I am wrong and that the government is not contemplating using that money to fund its capital projects or government-owned companies simply because it is committed not to borrow or donate government surplus to community care, or because its projections of rising revenue and expenditure are out of kilter. The consequences for these annual debates and transparency of government finances would be considerable, because it would blow a massive hole in the government's duty to account to this House at budget time for expenditure, because we all know the Gibraltar Savings Bank expenditure is not reflected in these estimates. End quote. That was in 2013, Mr. Speaker, in 2013. Shortly before that, and unbeknown to us, the government had already started shifting monies from the Gibraltar Savings Bank to Gibraltar Investment Holdings Limited. That's the company that stands at the top of the pyramid of government-owned companies, where government have traditionally injected money, and it cascades down to all the other government-owned companies. And indeed, within a year, they poured 300 million, rising to 400 million, into Credit Finance Company Limited. Despite the considerable difficulties placed in our path, we on this side of the House predicted precisely how it was to be done and the implications that it would all have for these annual debates, Mr. Speaker. The government kept its promise to spend 750 million in capital projects, but we were proved right as to how they would fund it. Of course, we all know that the government could never have borrowed that amount of money directly because of the statutory debt limits, ironically introduced to ensure that governments do not spend on behalf of a community in a manner that is unaffordable, Mr. Speaker. And that is precisely why, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable the Chief Minister on Tuesday, during the course of his intervention, as highlighted by the Leader of the Opposition and by Mr. Clinton, admitted that they ploughed all these hundreds of millions of pounds into government-owned companies, precisely to circumvent the legal borrowing limits, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, they have done some good things. And I accept that. They have done. You do not win three elections in a row if you do not do some good things, Mr. Speaker. But the way that they have managed the public finances has been reckless and indeed politically dishonest, Mr. Speaker. And it is not right to say that the GSD government did the same. The only reason why any of this became possible was because they changed the law. They, in 2012, came to this House and changed the Gibraltar Savings Bank Act. Because when we were in government, the Gibraltar Savings Bank Act provided that the proceeds of debentures could only be invested in cash or cash equivalents, very safe forms of investment. They came to this House in 2012, they changed the law in order to allow the Gibraltar Savings Bank to invest in anything and everything, Mr. Speaker. Speaker, on Tuesday, we heard that recurrent revenue is no longer covering recurrent expenditure, and that we're now borrowing to cover recurrent expenditure. Of course, you cannot ignore the realities of the pandemic and Brexit. But we've been warning about the rise of recurrent expenditure since at least 2013. Some of the rises in departmental expenditure was causing the Minister of Economic Development as much discomfort as it was causing us, Mr. Speaker. It was all terribly confusing. The GSD, defending the prudent fiscal core values with which the Honourable Member, the Minister for Economic Development, had been associated all his life, whilst his own party, were ignoring these core values. Honourable Members will recall that when asked by Jonathan Scott of GBC whether the rise in departmental expenditure accorded with his core values, the Minister, Sir Joe, said that consultants were brainwashing government ministers to spend without guilt, Mr. Speaker. That's what he said on public television. And therefore, whilst undoubtedly the current predicament is COVID-based, the trend, the clear trend and clear concern was already there prior to COVID, Mr. Speaker. In 2019, pre-COVID, the Minister for Economic Development gave a health warning on public television about the amounts of money that his own government was spending by way of recurrent expenditure. That was the warning that he gave. We had been warning about it since 2013-14 and referring to the experiences of other small jurisdictions like Bermuda, where governments were there, changed the borrowing limits, as they have done, and ended up borrowing to pay recurrent expenditure. And they have come to this House, Mr. Speaker, to talk about the age of responsibility. I mean, are we real, Mr. Speaker? Our philosophy has been a strong economy, sound public finances, money in the bank to see us through difficult times. Those are the true foundations, Mr. Speaker, of a successful society. That is a way to protect the Gibraltarian way of life, our public services, and ordinary working class people, not spending 14 million on a concert. All of which, Mr. Speaker, has been threatened by their management of the public finances. And now, in our time of need, we're in a worse position than we would have been to weather this storm. We were never the party of austerity, Mr. Speaker. Despite the scandalous attempts by some then members of Unite, including a Unite UK official, attempting during a general election to paint us as such, no doubt, Mr. Speaker, to please them. If the government had listened to us and their own Minister for Economic Development all those years ago and reined in government expenditure, we would have undoubtedly, and I repeat, and I will repeat, in a better position to deal with the current crisis. In the meantime, not only has overall debt, direct and indirect, risen from 500 million to 1.7 billion today, but the government has mortgaged
government housing estates to secure and procure part of that borrowing, all pre-COVID, Mr. Speaker. Indeed, instead of heeding our warnings about huge increases in debt, they legislated in 2016 to change the amounts the government could borrow, despite the fact that we had fought the 2015 election on debt and spending, and at no stage did members opposite say that they would be changing the debt limit to borrow even more, Mr. Speaker. Even more. Didn't do that. Just that they didn't say to the electorate in 2011, we're going to be changing the Gibraltar Savings Bank Act, because the way that we're going to be paying for the 750 million is through the Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, we accept that every country borrows, that when used correctly, public debt improves the standard of living of a country. We accept all that. But debt can also be a millstone that impacts not only on today's generation of taxpayers, but it can also affect future generations in a small community. If you're not careful, as again we warned, debt becomes deferred taxation, and we're now seeing that in increases in social security payments and also in corporate tax. It is true that our small size makes us agile and responsive, but there are structural issues in our economy which have always made us vulnerable. Import duty revenues, largely derived from tobacco revenue, a dependency on the gaming sector, and a public service-dominated economy. I also want to say this, Mr. Speaker. Yes, there must be a collective change of chip. I said that on many, many occasions. I agree with the honourable gentleman opposite when they say we cannot continue to behave like the spoiled child of Europe. But every parent will tell you that the best way to prevent that is not giving a child everything it wants. They are the ones that have spoilt the child, despite our warnings about the insipid social effects of their uncontrolled spending and promises. For many years, people didn't care about public debt or the amount of money the government was spending. As long as they had money in their pocket and their two cars in the garage, they didn't care. The moment there are difficult times and either the public service expansion is frozen or someone is refused a request, however unreasonable, spent too much money. When the government was spending and borrowing as if there was no tomorrow, but things were okay, the GSD no se calla. The GSD doesn't keep quiet. There's no point in complaining after the horse has bolted. We've all got to do our bit. And in fairness, that has been our message over the last 10 years. All of us, politicians and the electorate, if we continue to turn elections into souks and the public continues to judge politicians by the promises they make, however unreasonable and unaffordable, we will not prosper in the way that we have in the past. Or worse, Mr. Speaker, we have voices which have never been heard in Gibraltar, that we need to do a deal with Spain, however unpalatable and however unacceptable.
Never.
No, 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 Mr. Speaker. No, 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 Mr. Speaker. But that's why we spend so much time from this side of the House on politically unattractive arguments about debt and public spending. And Mr. Speaker, when I say no, 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 in this I do trust the government. I do trust that the government will not agree to the total capitulation that is represented by the EU negotiating mandate. Neither the Chief Minister, nor the Deputy Chief Minister, nor any of the members opposite will agree to that. That is why we welcomed the intervention of the Deputy Chief Minister on Tuesday and his very clear commitment to this House, together with a very clear commitment of the government subsequent to that. Mr. Speaker, indeed, Mr. Speaker, before I turn to the contributions of some of the other members opposite, and I won't take very long, Mr. Speaker, I just want to say something about those negotiations. We were concerned by the in-principle agreement when it was announced. The government has dealt with some of those concerns by promising that there will be no Spanish police boots on the ground at the airport or at the port. That was a major concern for us, and we welcome that promise. It is not a secret, that perhaps I, and I speak only personally, I don't speak for anybody when I say this, that perhaps I would have seen Brexit as an opportunity to secure closer constitutional links with the United Kingdom. But that is neither the policy of the government, nor indeed is it the policy of the opposition. There is therefore only one horse in this race, and for the sake of everyone, it must be given the maximum opportunity to succeed. The leader of the opposition has rightly emphasized that whatever our reservations, the government must be given an opportunity to agree a deal that eliminates the frontier, I'm not talking physically, I'm talking as a political pressure point, and we agree that that is going to involve a level of political compromise. Compromise, yes, Mr. Speaker, but capitulation, no. We need to go into this process with an open mind, but firm in what we can and cannot agree. In the Brexit Select Committee and in this House in 2017-18, I told the government on various occasions that it had the duty to explore some type of customs union application to Gibraltar, provided we could safeguard businesses, and I was assured that studies had been undertaken by the government and the government was confident that a balance could be maintained. On this side of the House, we wish the government well in attempting to strike that balance, and the Leader of the Opposition has asked me to convey the fact that we are here, as indeed he was personally, Mr. Speaker, the Leader of the Opposition, to assist the government wherever we can. To Spain, I have this message. Our overwhelming market in financial services and gaming is the UK. The father of this house said during the course of his intervention that in 2019 our trade with the UK was worth £4.6 billion, up from £1.6 billion in 2011. The deep economic links and indeed economic integration with the UK is there for all to see, accelerated by Brexit. If these negotiations fail because of shenanigans either from Europe or Spain, those links will only increase, Mr. Speaker. Inevitably, a large part of our economic offering will need to focus on the UK's plans, these trade deals, and we will then have to determine what we can offer to get a slice of that action. Mr. Speaker, at the moment, UK trade deals with third parties do not automatically extend to Gibraltar. And the time may come when we want to reverse that. They should automatically apply unless we suggest otherwise. Either way, Gibraltar will not be EU-facing despite our geographic position and despite our wish to be European-facing, Mr. Speaker. That can have potential future political and constitutional implications. Our children speak less Spanish today than they have ever done. I don't personally welcome that. But if the EU and Spain want Gibraltar to look elsewhere for its economic future, the negotiating mandate actually does that, Mr. Speaker. I want to turn, Mr. Speaker, to some of the comments made by the Father of the House in his very interesting, if lengthy, historical lesson on community care yesterday. He used phrases like, quote, they have legitimized what we have spent 34 years defending against, end quote. Or he said that the participation by members of this side of the House in a demonstration some weeks ago represents support for, and I quote, a level of insanity without parallel. Mr. Speaker, the majority of those participating were GSLP activists, Mr. Speaker, in that demonstration. but the only person that I have ever heard in my time in this House drawing a link between government control and community care was the Honourable Member, the Minister for Economic Development, in his own intervention yesterday, when he referred to internal and confidential government memoranda, Mr. Speaker. No one has ever drawn that link. It was one of those dangerous speeches we have heard on the subject, and whilst we associate ourselves from this side of the House with much of what the Honourable Minister said yesterday on departmental expenditure and the culture of entitlement, which we have been saying for many years, we completely disassociate ourselves from the link that he drew between government influence and community care, and we invite the government to do likewise, Mr. Speaker. The GSD will not stop the funding of community care, which is the maximum extent of government influence on the charity. No one on this side signed the petition. The sole point that we have made is that the sudden 17th of February 2020 removal of payments without consultation seemed arbitrary and unfair. There should be a moratorium and new arrangements discussed and transitioned with full consultation, Mr. Speaker. Full stop. That is the extent of what we have said. As for the old age pension, we're going to have to deal with this, Mr. Speaker. We cannot stick our heads in the sand. It's unconstitutional. It's clear discrimination on grounds of sex. The government may wish to, Mr. Speaker, consider setting up a committee along the lines of the Ganeba Committee on Democratic Reform, composed of a cross-section of the community, to advise the government and make recommendations on how this is to be dealt with. But dealt with it has to be, Mr. Speaker. Samantha Sacramento, and of course I associate myself entirely with the speech of my learned and honourable friend, Mr. Phillips, the fire he shows in his belly is an essential component, Mr. Speaker, an essential component of successful opposition politics, and no one has shown more fire in his belly since the last election than Mr. Phillips, and I congratulate him for that. Now, of course, Mr. Speaker, I am getting on a bit, Mr. Speaker. The fire doesn't shine as brightly. And the belly, despite my best efforts, the belly isn't what it used to be. I'm not sure I want to associate myself with the honourable gentleman on that one. No, I don't. But Mr. Speaker, I do want to congratulate the honourable lady who is not here to hear my congratulations. But I do want to congratulate the honourable lady on her handling of the COVID crisis. The vaccination program and the way testing is done in particular has been absolutely nothing short of brilliant. The airport testing facility with which I am most familiar is a credit to her and the rest of Gibraltar. And I speak as someone who has had numerous tests in the UK this year, and they don't come anywhere near the level of organisation and customer service of our facility in Gibraltar. Yes. Mr. Speaker, I want to end. I had some further points to make, but I think it's late. But I want to end, Mr. Speaker. I want to end by giving the Chief Minister a gift, Mr. Speaker. He may recall that he gave me once a gift during the course of these debates. No. Wait for it. Don't try and steal the punchline. No. He gave me a calculator. Mr. Speaker, I have in my possession one of my most prized political treasures, Mr. Speaker. It's an annual. It's dated 2001. It's by Peter the Python, Mr. Speaker. Excellent. It's by Peter the Python. Mr. Speaker, Peter the Python was somebody who would write in the New People, and these are a compilation of all the articles that appeared by Peter the Python in 2001 in the New People. And of course it was a parody of Peter Caruana at the time, obviously anonymous, Peter the Piper. And it is dedicated, Mr. Speaker, to the editor of the New People, Clive Galt. It says, to my dear, it's original. To my dear editor, thank you for the chance to put my views. You discover another of my hidden talents. All the best for 2002, The Python. And of course, Mr. Speaker, the Python, we all know who the Python was, Mr. Speaker, and it was the Honourable Gentleman. The political point, Mr. Speaker, the political, I was a socialist worker. And there are probably.
I am.
But Mr. Speaker, the political point of this gift is that during the course of this reply, Mr. Speaker, when he accuses us of being anti-Gibraltarian, Mr. Speaker, conducting terrible politics and doing Gibraltar down. He should remember some of the stuff that he wrote at the time, Mr. Speaker. And I just have some of my favourites. Talk Dirty. And it's got a photograph of Clive Galt, Hawk excluded by Python. And then it has another photograph of a couple of doves, and it says, the Pipe's first political party, Mr. Speaker. And then there's a photograph of my honourable and learned friend, Mr. Sopardi. Secret deal, how do you feel, sin veto, veto. And El Palomo vuelve a Madrid, and that's a picture of the greatest Gibraltarian of our time, with the caption underneath, dovish trip, Mr. Speaker. But my personal favourite, Mr. Speaker, Peter the Python's Flying Circus. He has all his balls in the air, and I think it says yours in a vice, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, if I may hand the...
The house.
No.
I thought that's how you were going to do this.
If you don't want to give it back to me, because it is one of my most treasured... One of my treasured possessions, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I too want to thank. No. I'm inviting it. Mr. Speaker, I too want to thank Mr. Speaker, all members of Mr. Speaker's staff, and I too add my voices to the many voices during the course of the debate, offering Mr. Martinez the best of retirements. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, for your patience.
Mr. Speaker, before I am able to reply to the Honourable Gentleman and refresh his memory about the Planet of the Tapes or the Cuban Missives Crisis, to which he contributed a huge amount of inspiration, and some of the other great moments like Wallace and Mr. Python, I shall ask the House to adjourn to quell the fire that he has lit, so that we can come back tomorrow to listen to the Honourable Lady and the Honourable the Backbencher before our reply on Monday, something which I know he will now be particularly looking forward to, although I promise, Mr. Speaker, that although he has revealed who Peter the Python was, I won't go back to dwell on the revelation about who wrote Michael Bain's social media posts. And I propose, Mr. Speaker, that we should return tomorrow at 4:15 for that purpose. Prime time.
I now propose the question, which is that this House do now adjourn to Friday the 23rd of July at 4:15 p.m. I now put the question which is that this House do now adjourn to Friday the 23rd of July at 4:15. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Pass. The House will now adjourn to Friday the 23rd of July at 4:15 p.m.